Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, I thought I missed it, and I guess I did. I missed the intro. How did I do that?
How in the world, Mike?
How did I do that? Okay, we're going to go to the intro now.
One of those kind of faux intros.
Nah, we got to do one more time here. Now make no sense.
The following takes place between 3 p.m. and 6 p.m.
Now, that's how it was supposed to go. I don't know. We got the delay. We got the malfunction of the malfunction.
I call for an investigation.
We need an investigation. Let's have an investigation on that. Who should we call? Oh, how about Randy Maestro? Christie's attorney. That's who I want. Because he solves everything in the correct way.
Well, he can't find a problem.
Well, that's why he said there is no problem.
There is no problem.
There is no problem.
Cones or cones.
That's right.
Your problem.
There is no problem.
So what bridge was shut down? What about it?
The freaking bridge. Give me a daggone break here. We're going to have a great show today. We got bridges. We got all sorts of stuff. We got how about the Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana.
What new joy has he?
He's taking Medicaid.
Oh.
Expansion. Oh, but he doesn't call it Medicaid expansion.
Does that make it even trouble with the hardline base?
He's calling it the Healthy Indiana plan.
So you accept the government money, and then you call it something.
Right. It's not Affordable Care Act. It's not money from the federal government, to which President Barack Hussein Obama is the president of. This is just money they picked up out of the trees that the squirrels dropped off to them.
Our governor, you know, Governor Duke Energy, he should...
No, you mean Governor our Pope.
Well, yeah, well, you know, the Pope and the Duke, you know, kind of like a little kingdom here.
Right.
But they should follow that plan.
They should
accept federal aid and call it, like, you know, Duke Carolina Beneficiary Plan for Children and...
Well, that's what they're planning on doing. They're planning on doing that.
Because then you can blame Obama.
Yes.
For socializing.
For socializing.
And ruining it.
Right.
While simultaneously accepting it, using it for your own benefit, but calling it something after yourself. You know, like the Reagan plan for medicine or something.
Oh, well, yes, because Reagan's only been dead for five generations.
And, you know, that's what they do now, name post offices and airports and buildings out there. But I guess you couldn't really get away with naming a drug trade slash kill the nuns slash weapons trade fiasco in the Middle East slash South America gate.
Listen,
couldn't get away with that. So you have to name the post office.
Governor Mike Pence is optimistic.
Oh, he's optimistic.
He's optimistic that the feds will accept his Medicaid alternative. He says he has come up with a plan to expand health care coverage to uninsured low-income adults that will pass muster with the federal government. So wait a minute.
Like medical aid?
No, it's Healthy Indiana Plan.
Oh, yeah. Is it an affordable healthcare?
Yeah, well, the Republican governor said, who will announce this plan, which he already has,
because it's already
as an affordable for citizens, fiscally sound for the state, and better consumer-driven alternative than expanding the traditional Medicaid. It will refine the expansion of the state's current but limited health care plan. Pence repeatedly has shunned an expansion of traditional Medicaid, as outlined by the president.
Yeah, how dare he? Help the poor?
By saying it doesn't require recipients to take personal responsibility for their health care.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't. So that means when you're sick, you don't go to the doctor. Is that what it's saying? With the Affordable Care Act, you don't go. Isn't that your responsibility to go to the doctor? Because, hey, it ain't do you no good if you don't go to the doctor. Pence repeatedly has shunned the expansion of traditional Medicaid. Okay, it's a system that doesn't need to be expanded. It needs to be reformed, he said during a briefing Star's editorial staff on Wednesday. Obama's bailout not ruled out. Well, point. Obama's enrollment surge at N in Indiana. More than a year in the making, HIP 2.0, as his staff has nicknamed it, will replace the traditional Medicaid for all non-disabled Hoosiers age 19 to 64 with incomes up to 135% of the federal poverty rate. Now, wait a minute. Are you telling me you have to have up to 100? I mean, how poor are you if you're up to 138% of the you must be living in a paper cardboard box.
Or just working at McDonald's. But,
oh, well, that's true, too. That's true. Yeah, I forgot about that.
My favorite part about this is that it says if the federal government accepts his plan, it's going to expand coverage to an additional 350,000 Hoosiers, okay, who now lack a viable health insurance option. Why do they lack it? And why would it expand to them?
Okay.
Maybe because they blocked the expansion of Medicare.
Hmm.
It's almost as if it were the same thing.
Almost wants to say, there's something not
but you got to give them credit. You got to give them credit. They're using the Karl Rove plan of wordplay. Because just like USA Patriot Act, who'd want to vote against that? It sounds so patriotic. Something that's called HIP 2.0. I mean, come on. You got to give a high five on that. It's so hip.
No.
Obamacare was such a downer.
It's just that they have HIP in a lot of major cities throughout this country. I mean, half the city. My mother worked for the city of New York, and that's what she had. HIP was her health care insurance company. It's all over the country.
HIP.
It's in every state.
Yeah.
So he's going to expand HIP.
It's called Medicare.
Medicaid.
These people are just morons.
But who are the people that think this HIP that he wants to do?
But here's the thing, Mike. They have
and the ACA are not related to Obamacare. How brain dead are you?
Because this is the problem. Because, you know, this is what they do. They so demonized everything to do with Obama. Everything to do with his administration, every law he's ever even associated with, that you can't even now in Republican circles use it. Because why would you use something that was supported by a Islamo-fascist Kenyan terrorist who's taken over the White House and is a traitor and needs to be impeached?
Absolutely.
That's what you tell them every breath. So you can't accept it. So what you have to do now, because if you see all the polls, they're losing their butt everywhere. And now they've started saying things like, well, we won't completely abolish and repeal Obamacare.
Right.
We'll reform it. That's the new edge. We'll reform if we get in there.
Do these people take English in school?
But,
the people
you know,
that
again,
listen to that?
It's the same thing with a new name, and they pretend it's
true. Just listen to what Ted Cruz said.
We're saying they want health care. Do not realize that expanding Medicaid will worsen the health care options for the most vulnerable among us in Texas.
Texas will not be held hostage by the Obama administration's attempt to force us into this fool's errand.
I like how they throw every word possible.
Every adjective that's in there. Give me that dictionary. What can we use here? Where's the thesaurus? Come on, give it out. What can we throw in there? Because remember, our people are listening to Fox. They can't read, write, or understand English.
And this is the same people, though. If you remember a while back when the tornadoes were tearing up those parts of the country, they said that Obama was using weather manipulation machinery from the Pentagon.
Voodoo from the Pentagon. Yeah.
I mean, you know, come on. It makes sense when you think about it in their world.
Their world is so...
And what I love about this is that they're anti-science. They claim that there's no climate change. There's no emergency due to pollution and other things. And yet, in the same breath, they'll say, but the president can use devices to wage weather war.
Weather war.
So if science doesn't exist...
Oh,
can you wage weather?
Hey, just listen to Senator Ted Cruz and Kelly Ayotte.
What is a viable alternative that really solves the problem?
Well, I would say let's get to the table on a bipartisan basis, and let's make sure that we have a plan that has more choice, not less.
You don't think that you have a responsibility as a U.S. senator to do better than that in terms of offering a solution for what to do next?
Well, I appreciate you're trying to lecture me in the morning.
I appreciate you trying to lecture me in the morning. That's so pithy.
Unbelievable.
Here's the part that cracks me up. They're so against Obamacare, which, you know, in the name, they change, you know, it's not the Affordable Care Act.
Oh, no.
That sounds like it's affordable and caring.
That's right.
So, Obamacare, you know, it's like the abomination. So
the Abomination Care Act.
Yes. But they've had, like everybody else in this country, 70 years to work on a plan. And if you remember, we had several plans on the Democratic side, from absolutely free-a-thon to single-payer to all these other different plans, different levels. And then we even went so far as to say, if you'll just pass anything, we'll compromise with you. So we sat in that committee and we said, what do you want to do? And they went, use our plan. Yeah, here's the plan that we used up in another state. You can try it out. And we went, okay, whatever it takes. And we threw single player in the garbage can, and we used the plan, everything else. But then still went past it. They go, oh, my God, it's under his watch. We've got to demonize it.
Well, here's what John Bona said. John Boehner. This is what he said.
To lay the groundwork before we begin to repeal monstrosity and replace it with common sense reforms. This bill ought to be repealed and replaced. That's why we voted over 30 times. To repeal it, to fund it, replace it. We want to repeal Obamacare and replace it with patient-centered health care. That's why we need to repeal this law and replace it.
You know, again with the adjective,
I mean,
monster, ogre,
monstrosity.
It's troll care. You know, I mean, come on. Yeah, I was watching Shrek the other night, and they can actually go from
the Speaker of the House
to Shrek in a blink of an eye, and it makes sense.
Yes.
There's a major problem.
Yes. Like I was just saying a minute ago, these guys not only have had 70 years like the rest of the country.
Yeah.
Well, they spent the last, you know, 6 years demonizing everything this guy has done. And just saying at every breath, you know, that was old news, by the way, you played. They've almost doubled that now. We're closing in on 60 repeals, you know. That was 30.
Yeah, that's true. That's
okay.
True.
Okay, but they're so, you know, hyper about it. You would think, just like that clip you played a minute ago, they'd have an alternative. You know, even one.
Well,
so you start asking, well, what is your alternative? And then they're like, way to catch me in the morning,
his,
Bob.
His,
you know, you've had 76 years.
His... Mr. Cantha.
We do not believe that Obamacare can work, and we don't feel that it is properly achieving the goals that the president promised his country it would. And we are about proposing real health care reform, that it will be patient-centered, and a plan that we will put forward this year.
Where's the plan?
We will.
Well, where's the plan?
Yeah.
What's the plan?
You're eight. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, you know, and it don't matter how often you play these things. Year later, 3 years later, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
You're still saying the same thing.
They've been saying it since the beginning. You know, we've got an alternative plan. They'll pass it. That's why I like his name. It's can't or won't.
Well, you see, no. but
which is it? Can't or won't?
Now, here's the real clue. This guy, Bill Cassidy, Representative Bill Cassidy, Republican.
That I actually think reflects the reality of who the uninsured are. Relatively less sophisticated, less comfortable with forms, less educated.
In what looks like some new age health coverage conga, Candace McRae celebrates her enrollment under the Affordable Care Act. It's been more than a year since she's had health insurance because her employer doesn't provide it.
I've been without health insurance as of May. It will be 5 years.
As of today, Sue Frazier will not have to go another year without it because she just found out
I'm eligible for free health insurance.
I haven't had insurance since before I can remember. So this is really a godsend.
Well, it was kind of hard to hear what Representative Bill Cassidy said. He said, the uninsured can't read. So why are we giving them health insurance? We need to tell them what they have to do. I me. They can't read. No, the people that voted for him can't read.
Right. And again, it's just like, you know, have a option, have a choice. Quit just claiming all the time. Even like Cantor said, it doesn't work. It's not being implemented right. It doesn't reach its goals. Actually, it is working. It's already been implemented. And it's already exceeded its goal of sign-up. So what are you talking about? I mean, again, what statement are you making?
I mean, it's just completely, we'll listen to just a little bit of the great governor from the state of Texas.
The real issue of the day is Obamacare. It's the president of the United States who stood up in front of people for literally years and said that if you like your policy, you will be able to keep it. One of the interesting things in that clip that you had on earlier, the president said that he had been working very, very hard moving people into the middle class. I think that's another trust issue that this president has. Unemployment numbers just came out today. Unemployment is up in the United States. And you're seeing the underemployed and those that have just quit looking up to 13.8% now. It's been this president's policies over the course of the last 5 years that have driven people out of the middle class. So the trust issue that you hit on, I think that is the big one for this president. Americans do not trust Barack Obama.
Well, let me ask you, though, about health care. And by the way, though, the jobs numbers were pretty good today. Those are good. We added almost 300,000 jobs that we didn't know we had, 200,000 this month and some revisions.
These numbers are abysmal. When you think that there is approaching 14% of the people that are either underemployed, Obamacare is moving people into the partially employed line. That is just unacceptable. Our economy should be cranking along. If we would open up the XL pipeline, if we'd put a flat tax into place, if we'd repatriate foreign-made money at a reasonable tax rate, the American economy would take off. Yet this president is so intent on this experimentation with big government that no one trusts Washington to be putting policies into place that allow them the predictability of what's going to happen 6 months or even maybe next month.
Let me ask you this about some statistics in the state of Texas and ask you why you don't think government should, or what you think the government should do to try to fix this, or what you think you should do. In Texas, you rank 50th out of 50 among the number of uninsured residents, and the high school graduation rate in Texas is 49th out of 50th. So I guess I ask you this is that sustainable for the state of Texas? You guys have this great economic boom that's been going on, cover of Time magazine, but these statistics, doesn't at some point that's going to drag Texas down? Do you worry about that?
Two things. Number one, the Texas is a conservative state. It is a state that has made the decision internally that they're going to have less of the type of big government programs that Washington, D.C. Fronts. So it is not surprising that there are that number of people who don't have insurance. But the issue is, do they have access to health care? And the answer is absolutely some of the best health care in the world. So the issue there, I think, is Texans have decided, legislature after legislature, this is the program that they're going to put in place. And I don't think Texans want Washington, D.C. saying, you're going to change the way you do your business. No, we're not. And we said that over and over again. Texas is third in graduation rate numbers. I don't know where you get that 50th and 50th.
Well, this came from the state educational attainment part of that.
They're wrong. We are 30th. Our graduation numbers are the third highest in the United States. So we're making good progress. Our African-American and Hispanic students are scoring some of the highest with the National Assessment of Education Progress. Just in 2011, we've seen them move up substantially in the last decade. So thousands of people are moving into the state of Texas. They wouldn't be coming there if they were worried about whether or not they're going to have access to health care or whether or not there's going to be a skilled workforce. I think the numbers speak for themselves. People are coming to the state of Texas because there's still a place that freedom reigns, and they want to be a part of that.
Yeah, those people coming into Texas is the Medellin cartel.
Yeah.
I mean, he said his own state education system is wrong.
Right.
I mean, Are you kidding me?
Where'd you get those facts from?
That's right, because, you know, I don't know nothing about facts. So it's just, name me the three things you want to cut. Well, it's, whoops. Give me a break. He said, everybody's got access to health care in Texas. Oh, really? How? The emergency room?
That's why, look, we have a very, we're proud of our system. It's the best health care in the world.
Because you belong to America,
you moron. Now, look, here's the thing.
50 out of 50. You didn't even phase them.
His answer was, he said, how do you explain this? What are you doing wrong? You know, what are you going to do to change
that?
And he said, we're a conservative state.
So we ain't going to change it.
Yeah.
We want to be 60th out of 50. how soon can we get there? You mean
we
the Well, he thinks there's 60 states.
No.
I would bet you, name me the 60 states. He'll say, he won't even acknowledge that you're 60. He'll start naming them. Oh, then he'll get the 50 and say, whoops, if he got the 50.
Well, you know, in La La Land, Texas didn't name a state. It's its own republic.
That's true, because Davy Crockett said so. Because Davy Crockett said so.
That's when they should just have a cattle skull head for their symbol.
I mean, 49th in graduation of high school, 50th.
And he says, no, we're third.
In what world?
Yeah, this is your own statistics. Well, they're wrong. Yeah, okay. They're wrong, all right.
This is the land of, look, this is a state that's the size of most countries, and yet this is the land of, they just close almost every abortion clinic in the entire state.
They got one in the southwest corner.
Yeah.
Close to wherever it was. I don't know where it was.
I mean, people drive for days just to get health care in their great, illustrious state. You know, so anyway, they don't care. Like, they don't care.
They don't care.
To even point out their own statistics in their conservative government. Then they say you're lying.
We need to look up what the death rate is. Did you see what the death rate is in Texas?
I was trying to count them, but they've actually clogged the entire Rio Grande all the way down. You can't quite count the bodies.
Holy cow. I mean, well, moving right along.
Well, I want to throw this factoid out there.
Throw that factoid along.
This is just to deal with what we were talking about earlier with We Hate Obama.
Huh?
But this is just a great one. I sent this to you the other day. But so this is talking about presidential nominees, you know, to the bench and stuff. So it says the number of presidential nominees that have been filibustered in the history
of the
United States.
This is the history.
Since the founding of the country.
Since 1776.
Since George. Since the very beginning of the country to now, there have been 168 nominees that a president has made that have been filibustered by the Congress.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Wow. 168. Okay.
That's less than one a year.
Right. Now.
Here's the history of the country.
86 of those filibusters
have
been under other presidents from the beginning of the country to now.
And we had how many presidents? 45?
82 have been blocked so far under Obama. Obama.
82 out of 83?
Out of
86.
So Obama is sitting at about 48% of all the filibuster appointees in the history of the country.
And
by himself, he's had more people filibustered than all presidents combined.
How do you explain that, Mr. Bona?
Now, that's just their rampant hatred of everything Obama. It doesn't matter what he does. They're just obstructionists. That's all they do. So they want to shut down the government. So we've literally, in the last 6 years, had more than in the last, 250 years. So take that. That insurgent terrorist.
Real. That's because he's an insurgent Kenyan communist socialist.
You forgot Nazi.
Nazi terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And they say all these things.
All right. Now, let's move right along here.
Moving.
Let's move right along here.
Where are we going?
And let's talk about the just released National Climate Assessment.
That's such a big topic, though. I was hoping we'd talk about that police chief with his little mouth.
His little problem. Oh, his little. I thought you were talking about something else, but he got that too. But we're going to get to that. It is a big subject, but a big subject calls for
big
changes.
Because people don't understand how things accumulate. And I know that's another big science word.
I want to know.
If you take a tailpipe of your car and you're driving across Texas,
and you stick it in the car
blowing off of the desert, and there's some sagebrush tumbling around, and you're just driving along, whipping past the cattle ranch.
Roman.
You got your window up.
Keep them doggies
rolling.
And you
got the air conditioning cranked on high.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm.
And you got the radio on.
Mm-hmm.
You don't notice that the exhaust out of your car is kind of stinky. You don't even notice because it's blowing behind you. You're going 900 miles an hour.
I had dual carburetors. Mine doesn't stink.
Mm-hmm.
It filters all that out.
But,
it goes out and it gets filtered.
If you have a couple hundred million people, say, as citizens, and everybody's got a car, and everybody's driving around listening to the radio, it adds up.
Thank you, guys.
It adds up to a lot of poison that seeps up into the air. And then if you throw in a few, smokestacks and factories and, Duke power plants and other things that are belching all day long, it all starts to add up even more. And that's when we get to a problem like we have now. And they like to say, global warming doesn't exist. But it does. And it's a real problem.
Well,
and the proof of that is, as we said the other day, I would take every Republican and take this test. You don't believe in global warming?
No, wait a minute. You want them to take a test?
Yeah,
that means they have to write an answer.
Well, yeah, they won't even have to write the answer on this one.
Oh, okay.
Watch. This is an easy test.
All right.
Don't even need a pencil. Because you won't use it afterwards. So the easy test is, if you don't believe in global warming, if you think it's a democratic, liberal, hidden agenda, maybe,
right,
go to your garage, crank your car up.
And lay down in the back of the car.
Yeah, and just put,
pillow.
Open the windows and let the engine run, okay? And then try to breathe in that exhaust. Won't take long. Just keep on going.
Well, they that's what they want us to breathe, so we get used to this. We're on the smokestacks, and the car pollution makes it so massive under the canopy of this planet's air mass that we'll be used to it. And then, it'll be like in those horror movies, you see the people, the Morlocks. Mm-hmm. We'll be like the Morlocks.
Right.
Hey.
Well, to begin with, if science doesn't exist and all this, when you have an internal combustion engine that's putting off pollution, why do you think they have an engine at the front?
Now, stop that. You're telling those fancy words there.
I know.
Don't talk those fancy words.
The engine's at the front of a car.
Yeah.
And it's got all the axles and everything right there with the driver so that it can pull itself forward and have all the power up there. And it's pushing from the back, right?
Mm-hmm.
They changed all that. So everything's forward now, right? Well, why do you think, if the engine's up front, that they have a long, wasteful pipe running the length of a car, sticking out the back?
Because they could just have it in the front.
Yeah, they could just have it right now. I mean, they could stick it right up, straight out the top, or you can just even put it right into the air conditioning system and blow it on the people when they, drive.
Yeah, I'd like
what
that
would be
smell.
I mean, that would be easier, right?
Well,
point is, because it's poisonous, and you will die.
Well, I think, you must have failed science in school. Mm-hmm. Huh? Well, let me tell you what Dr. Republican Paul Brum says about that.
God's word is true. I've come to understand that. All that stuff I was taught about evolution and embryology and Big Bang theory, all that is lies straight from the pit of hell. And it's lies to try to keep me and all the folks who are taught that from understanding that they need a Savior. You see, there are a lot of scientific data that I found out as a scientist that actually show that this is really a young Earth. I don't believe that the Earth is but about 9,000 years old. I believe it was created in 6 days as we know them. That's what the Bible says. And what I've come to learn is that it's the manufacturer's handbook, is what I call it. It teaches us how to run our lives individually, how to run our families, how to run our churches. But it teaches us how to run all of public policy and everything in society. And that's the reason, as your congressman, I hold the Holy Bible as being the major directions to me of how I vote in Washington, D.C., and I will continue to do that.
Hallelujah. So, in other words, the Holy Bible is what he uses in the Senate and not the Constitution.
Yeah. Reminds me of somebody else.
You mean it's somebody else like that? Mm. Holy cow, we're in trouble.
Yeah, you know, there's a few others.
Well, we're in trouble.
What was that guy recently who said that the biblical law should supersede all other law? I mean, they say that all the time.
Oh, yeah.
That other guy, just recently. What's that other Republican? Nebraska Senate. No, it was this guy named Bill Dinsmore.
Oh, God, please. Hey, we didn't even get to him yet. Sasa?
If you have religious beliefs,
right,
it'll justify breaking of any law because the
absolutely
Bible supersedes Constitution.
Unbelievable.
But these people, like, again, if that's the way you feel, then put a hose from the car
up your nose.
Up your nose. And then see how many Bible verses you can recite
before you're dead.
Thank you.
That's right. Now, we also have the real, genuine Alzheimer patient, Senator Dal Emhoff.
Now, Senator, we're going to talk about your book for a minute. You state in your book, which, by the way, is called The Greatest Hoax. We'll tell you how you can get it in just a few moments. But you state in your book that one of your favorite Bible verses, Genesis 8:22, while the earth remaineth seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. What's the significance of these verses to this issue?
Well, the Genesis 8:22 that I use in there is, as long as the earth remains, there will be springtime, harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, day and night. My point is, God's still up there. And this is the arrogance of people who think that we, human beings, would be able to change what he is doing in the climate is, to me, outrageous.
Look, I don't understand. If you take a saw and you chop a tree down, does it fall down? Is it gone?
Well, we need pencils.
No, but it wouldn't fall down, right? You couldn't chop it down.
Because God wouldn't want you to chop it.
Right. And if
you hit it and it goes boing.
Yeah. And if you take your trash and you dump it all over the ground,
right,
does it magically disappear, or is it a pile of trash there?
Well, the rats will come and eat it.
And if you take your trash and your bleach and everything else and pour it into the river, I mean, does it pollute it or not? You remember, they used to have these little quaint little things. You remember this from growing up, because this is what helped change our laws.
I was too busy throwing trash in the ground.
You remember Lake Erie? You know,
Lake Erie,
in the creepy sense, because you know you could damn near set the thing on fire.
Yep.
And the Hudson, same way.
Yep.
You know, because of all the pollution. So then in the 60s they said, oh my gosh, the rivers are burning, literally burning. They're getting set fire to because of all the chemicals, and you can't drink out of them because you die instantly, and your babies are born with like no limbs.
Yeah.
So they created things like the EPA and the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act and all these things. So,
by the way, wasn't that a Richard Nixon thing we did?
Yeah, evil Republican.
So,
again, an evil Republican was even convinced when you see that when you pour your pollution into a river, you can't drink it. When you pour it on the ground, you can't use it. When you chop down a tree, there's no more tree. So where does he get off with this? I mean, I get your faith, but you can't just sit here and pretend that then there's nothing we can do that would affect the world because God is still up there.
But see, here's the thing. I think he's a liar. He don't have any faith. That's bullshit.
Faith,
the man just sees lying.
He has faith in his contributors to his bank account.
That's the only faith he has. That's the only faith he has is the green face of not even Washington.
Greed.
Not even Washington. Who's on a $1,000 bill?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know either.
I've never seen one.
Yeah, duh. That's who he has faith in. These people just lie for the sake of lying. And let's just listen to a little bit of what Bill Nye, the science guy, said about these creationists that is not appropriate for children.
I mean, we are the world's most advanced.
Technological.
So, I mean, you could say Japan. But generally, the United States is where most of the innovation still happens. People still move to the United States. And that's largely because of the intellectual capital we have, the general understanding of science. When you have a portion of the population that doesn't believe in that, it holds everybody back, really. Evolution is the fundamental idea in all of life science, in all of biology. It's like, it's very much analogous to trying to do geology without believing in tectonic plates. You're just not going to get the right answer. Your whole world is just going to be a mystery instead of an exciting place. As my old professor Carl Sagan said, when you're in love, you want to tell the world. So once in a while, I get people that really, that claim they don't believe in evolution. And my response generally is, well, why not? Really, why not? Your world just becomes fantastically complicated when you don't believe in evolution. I mean, here are these ancient dinosaur bones or fossils. Here is radioactivity. Here are distant stars that are just like our star, but that are a different point in their life cycle. The idea of deep time, of this billions of years, explains so much of the world around us. If you try to ignore that, your worldview just becomes crazy. It's just untenable, itself inconsistent. And I say to the grown-ups, if you want to deny evolution and live in your world that's completely inconsistent with everything we observe in the universe, that's fine. But don't make your kids do it, because we need them. We need scientifically literate voters and taxpayers for the future. We need people that can, we need engineers that can build stuff, solve problems. It's just really a hard thing. It's really a hard thing. You know, in another couple centuries, that worldview, I'm sure, will be, it just won't exist. I mean, it's there's no evidence for it, so.
I mean, you know, you listen to someone like him, and you understand we have what we call radiocarbon date testing, radiation testing. We know radiation lasts so many years in the bones. We know radiation will last so many years in the trees. Carbon date testing, you know, this bone, if we were 6,000 years old only, we were here with the dinosaurs. The radiation in the atmosphere, because we have radiation in the atmosphere all the time. But it's gotten worse after the 1940s.
And by the way, it was measurable by science. That's why we had to
measurable.
Stop. That's why we had to stop above ground testing.
Absolutely.
Because we started poisoning the air.
I mean,
we had to go to underground because people started getting radiation sickness.
That's right. So now we're all those moles that are underground, we're killing them.
Yeah.
The problem is, though, if a bone that we find has not even remotely close to the most oldest living person found, what does that tell you? I mean, one in one is two.
Right.
if it's so many rads that they're measuring from that's in the bone of this person, and then there's like 1/16 of that in this giant skull that we found, we can measure how old that skull is. How are they now saying that's bullshit? Everything's the same.
Right.
We could not have invented the atomic bomb if that is it.
Right. I mean,
so the people that listen to them are complete morons that take that in. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
Well, this whole rejection of science has been around for a while. We've had an endless battle between faith and science because and this is one thing I don't understand is why some people with faith can't have both ways. You know, I mean,
both ways. Now, wait a minute. Where are we going?
Yeah, but you know, science doesn't have to be incompatible with God.
No. Oh,
you know,
of course not.
But some people think
it's because of God we have science.
So, and that's one of the things that, you know, it's just a weird thing. But these know-nothings, they come out with this, it's a reaction to fear that somehow it will take away their faith. So then they reject all science, which is just stupid. It happens all the time. We have these know-nothings. But the ones that crack me up the most, like, you know, when you, for instance, they say the Bible's absolute. You can't contest any word of it. And it's a 6,000-year-old world. That's it. And then when you find,
were they measuring radiation back then?
Not only do we have a natural world going much further back with, you know, dinosaurs on this, but even the historical world predates that now. Because
now you're saying natural world now. Yeah, you're getting in the wrong.
So we even have, you know, civilizations that predate the 6,000-year mark far. So that in itself is, you know, laughable. That you've got people, you know, even advanced civilizations going back, and then on top of that, you get things like you were saying with science. Now, if science doesn't exist, you know, and everything has to come only from the Bible, you know, then where is the verse that says, you know, that I shall have a Boeing 747 or you know, a Sidewinder missile or a nuclear bomb or any of this other stuff? Because all of that came only from science and the accumulation of science, you know, the applied mathematics, applied chemistry, applied metallurgy, everything, you know, that you come up with is a development on something else. You know, this computer that we're working on, all this, you know, I looked up a minute ago. You asked me what was on the $1,000 bill?
Yeah.
I prayed for a while, but the answer didn't appear.
Didn't come?
So I typed into Google.
Oh.
And within...
You mean Google?
Within 1 nanosecond.
Those...
I got it. It's Grover Cleveland.
Those...
But now I have
biblical Anarchists?
Yeah.
Gave you the answer? But your prayer didn't?
It's kind of like that movie we watched. And a guy says, Google, not God, will move that information down into your brain.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, I mean, literally, I look this up. I see the whole history of it. I've got all the notes. I've got, you know, 1918, by the way, Alexander Hamilton was on the $1,000 bill.
Oh.
Then they changed it in 34 to Grover Cleveland. You know, little details like that.
A little president.
I've got the whole history of it right here. But
you mean
again, this was
you couldn't pray that into your brain?
Well, this is science. You know, there was no, I don't remember the, you know, David and his computers in the temple. So,
well, he did have the computer because he it was the, what do you call, who was the person that they went to with the one eye? That's the one that had the computer.
I was going to be really mean and say Odin, because Odin had one eye and he was the god of wisdom. But that would be mixing my beliefs. I'm sorry.
Listen, I worked for the Weather Service for 25 years. Let me tell you something now. Mm-hmm. Central Park, mm-hmm. for you people in Rio Linda, as Rush Limbaugh says, Central Park is where the National Weather Service, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
You know, the voice that comes up and goes, this is NOAA Weather Radio.
This is NOAA Weather Radio, right.
When you're
And Ed, I was going to call into Ed, and I didn't get a chance because he said the National Oceanic and, what do you say, the Aeronautical Administration the other day, so he's wrong. But anyway, when you're out in Central Park is where they take all the readings for measurements of dew point, rainfall, wind chill, wind speed, wind direction, all that. They take it in Central Park at the, they call it the, at the tower. I forgot what they call it now. It's been so long. But that's where they take the reading at. Now, how do you establish what the wind speed, wind direction, but especially the temperature is? Now, you put the wind speed, wind direction, you put up a barometer, and it will measure the speed and direction and everything. But the temperature and dew point, do you know how long it takes to take a temperature reading and to say New York City's temperature will be measured at this particular site, no matter how many other weather stations you have around the city?
Right.
It takes 32 years of measuring in one spot to then say, in the five boroughs of New York City, this is the temperature that we're going to say New York City is.
Yeah, the average.
Average is it.
Because you have a record.
But you have a record over 32 years for all sorts of conditions.
Mm-hmm.
That so this is something. Absolutely. So when a person or moron like Inhofe and the other morons, Cronin and Rubio, we're going to get to him too, say that, I don't believe in that. That can't be true. I don't believe those. I don't think they're where they're getting their readings from. Well, I don't know where they're getting their information from. Because, you know, they never say where they get it from.
They make it up.
They get it from Rush.
That's the difference.
Do they get it from Rush?
That's what makes me so mad about people who attack science. Science isn't a belief. Science doesn't have an agenda.
It's a belief, because Obama said so, so it's got to be a belief.
All it is a bunch of facts. And you have facts that are verifiable because other people can test them. You can test, you know, the temperature. You can go out with the thing. You don't say, I think it feels like 45 today. No, I think it's 50.
No. Is that right?
38, you know. You go out and you measure it, and you can tell exactly what temperature it is.
Oh, I don't think you can do that. Can you do that? Is that how you do that?
The difference between and one part that cracks me up, one of the things they say is they'll point out things in the past that they said scientists believed once. And then they'll say, see, and then they don't believe it anymore. They say something else.
Right? Yeah,
that's because the facts overturned the hypothesis, you moron. And that is exactly the point of science. If science were a belief system, it would always believe the same thing. But when a fact comes up, or a experiment is going on, and then you get different results than what you thought were the results, then it changes the fact. You know, I mean, it changes the statement, and you go, okay, then this is the reality of it. Because that is the whole point, is simple facts, and you can't mess with facts.
Well, these morons have never let a fact get in the way of fiction.
Of course.
And if I could find this from Rubio,
Rubio. Well, for now, Rubio.
Rubio, if I could play that, let's see. He is a senator. Too bad we got a moron like that. But,
we got one in here, and Senator Marco Rubio explains his position on climate change.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the thing that bothers me is that why?
Well, he says he doesn't believe that human activity affects climate change at all.
Of course not. Mm-hmm. And
Here's my answer to that. People think that humans can't affect climate and the Earth, right? But, you know, maybe one human can affect the entire climate of the Earth, but a couple billion of them sure can. And my example of that is one ant crawling across your yard, you may not even notice. But if you have a whole bunch of piles of ant beds that are like fire ants, let's say, and then you're walking across the yard, I guarantee you're going to notice that.
I saw a movie like that with Charlton Heston.
One ant may not have affected your day, but a whole bunch of fire
10 million?
They surely will. So
If I get this over here, I will talk about it. Yes, go ahead.
Rubio, when pressured on why he doesn't believe human activity and he doesn't believe in climate change, they said, name any facts or sources for that. And when pressed in two different interviews, he could not name a single source.
Of course not.
He couldn't come up with any fact.
How is he going to name a source when he'd have to lie? Oh, but he does that anyway. So it's better than saying, hey, there ain't none. There ain't none. I mean, it's just completely baloney. That's all it is. It doesn't exist. I mean, you know, they keep repeating the same lie.
Well, it goes back, though, from the old war room scenarios where they came up with this idea that if you repeat something over and over and over, it becomes factual. That's
yep.
the echo chamber you
mm-hmm,
know, they came
mm-hmm,
up with.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that with Fox. I mean, that's what they do is they just repeat something like, say, Clinton is a liar over and over and over and over
right.
until everybody believes it, no matter what the fact is. Or now they're doing it with Benghazi. Benghazi every 5 minutes. Oh, Benghazi gate. There's something going on. But that's what they'll do. And so if they just keep saying climate isn't changing, there is no global warming, it's all a myth, eventually somebody, somewhere, some yahoo on a farm somewhere, so, oh, yeah, that's true, I think.
On a farm? You mean like
I don't know.
The birds down in Arizona?
Or
Bungee
farm?
The Bungee Farm?
Oh,
I mean,
the Bundys.
Bundy Farm.
Yeah.
Bungie. Yeah, Bungie.
They ran out of money. They were begging for money.
Yeah.
To keep the militias going.
Oh, yeah.
They're asking for donations.
Yeah. I mean, can you actually believe that?
This cracks me up.
We're
tired of freeloading Americans and coming and stealing our jobs and taking our stuff and all of them blacks and stuff. So anyway,
yes,
we're going to squat here on public land by the federal government, and then we're going to ask for money for donations. You got any? Got spare change?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, come on. This is hysterical.
Let's put up a roadblock and make sure you give us money. Let's put up a roadblock. I mean, it's just freaking unbelievable. But anyway,
last month,
won't come up here. What?
Another favorite of ours, Senator Paul Rand.
Paul Rand.
Yeah, I'm calling him Paul Rand. Senator from Kentucky, which, you know, again.
Poor Rand.
Rand. Senator, which cracks me up to begin with, that this guy is a senator, and yet he's against the government. But anyway, he claims
How did that come out?
This cracks me up. He claims that the global warming development has become dumbed down.
What's dumbed down?
Rand Paul claims that the global warming debate has become dumbed down. The liberals have dumbed it all down and turned it into a talking point. Now, if there's anybody that's dumbed it down, let's think of a party. Can we think of a party?
Let's look at a call in here and see.
But one of the favorite
yes.
things here is that Al Gore recently addressed all this. You remember Al Gore? He's some
Gore.
Guy from the past. I don't know. He's kind of sharp figure. But anyway, he actually wrote a couple of books on environmental change and global warming. And, you know, which is far more. Where's Rand Paul's book? Anyway.
Well.
You know, again, I guess he had facts to put in the book. But
mm-hmm.
anyway, he said recently that it's quite obvious. The true motivations behind all these remarks are because of just currying favor for their mega donors like Charles and David Koch. Their name always confuses me.
Get you
it says, I don't think it's particularly complicated why they all cowed into abandoning that position, Gore said. They're going to face primary opponents financed by the Koch brothers and others who are going to who are part of their group, that if they even breathe the slightest breath of sympathy, or agree with the truth about climate science, they're going to be primaried out of existence. It's not really kind of complicated. They're running scared. That's what I'm absolutely positive about. And Gore continued on.
Yeah.
Paul. He said, of course, Senator Paul is from a coal state. But even if he were not, anyone who wants to set his or her aspirations on the Republican nomination for presidency already knows that they can't possibly cross the Koch brothers or any member of their group because they will lose all funding. So that's that. I mean, that's it. It's just these anti-statists who are really terrified of the government. They will do anything new. So as Grover Norquist famously said years ago, they want to shrink the government down to where it can be drowned in a bathtub. And this is their only agenda.
This is their only agenda. Now, you know, this is very important, because right now these people, a lot of see in on who are listening to Fox News constantly, they need to have their minds changed. Now, how do you get their minds changed? Well, you get their minds changed by having someone who can sit them down and coach them into what life is all about and how they can actually make a difference instead of being the stuff you throw out in the trash. I mean, because, you know, you have these people sitting around here who listen to Fox News 24/7, and they say, yes, that's right. Yes, that's right. What do you say? Yes, that's right. Yes, that's right. What do you say? So right now we have on our phone a young lady named Valerie Thomas who has 88 moments of coaching that will help these people realize just where the hell they're at. Hello, Valerie.
I think they all need a life coach.
You think they need a life coach?
I think if they all had life coaches, we could get rid of all the problems we have going on. We could take care of them spiritually and mentally and everything.
Yeah, but
let me ask.
But with a life coach, don't you have to have a life?
you do have to have a life, but sometimes other people's lives help my life to not be as bad as it can be because I have coachable moments. So I can coach, and I can coach on any level, but it comes back to me because now I have it in my Rolodex of what I will not be doing, sometimes what I will be doing, but it helps me with my life, and I limit the amount of coaching I do because it's physically taxing. It just mentally wears you down. But, I mean, a lot of people that you speak of, these politicians, a little bit of coaching might help them to deal with these situations a little bit differently. And I'm sure that they are harboring or holding on to a lot of nonsense that they should be coached out of, too.
Well, that gets to my question. My take on these people who live in this life of complete denial where science doesn't exist and, you know, government has no answers and blah, 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 and down.
You mean Clive and Bundy?
Yeah, my only explanation, because I can't understand the complete rejection of science and everything else. So my only choice is then that I guess they live in fear and they're scared of losing their beliefs. Well, they're scared of losing somehow their beliefs or their worldview that it's going to be threatened or taken away from them somehow with facts, you know. But is that accurate, or am I missing something, or why do these people live that way?
That is so interesting that you made that comment on science, because 3 days ago I had someone say, I am completely against counseling. So not that they don't think it works for them, not that they've experienced it and it just didn't go well, but I am against it, like it's the revolution. I don't know. Like, that is just nonsensical. You're not being an informed person to reject something. And science, which is proven, math is 1 + 1. That will never change. And, you know, science is what it is, and it's proven.
We're going to talk about that, because they have just come out yesterday. One of the things that the Republicans were talking about is that we do not want to teach math the same way to every single child, because they want to kill the core teaching of math.
Let me tell you something. My children are 18 and 16, and my niece is 9. If I had to learn math the way they learn math now, I would be on a street somewhere. And I think that might be part of the program. If we don't know how to count, then we won't be looking at where our tax dollars are going and how the government is spending money if we don't know how to add it up. But it doesn't make sense. They're making it harder and harder and harder to be educated, to be more informed, to be more advanced. It doesn't make sense. It's not progression. It's not win-win. It's lose. It's lose-lose. And I don't understand why people just reject before they know anything. I get it. You don't want to go bungee jumping off of a 100-foot tower. Like, that kind of makes sense that you're kind of against doing that because there's a real fear there. But just how you said earlier, the fear against with science, with me, with life coaching, people are afraid of a coaching or counseling, if you will, because they know something's coming out. They know they're going to have to deal with something that is fearful and that they want to shove down. But see how it's working? It's working in science. It's working in practical world. It's just a cycle that we're on, and it's not a good thing.
Yeah, but see, here's the thing. When they were talking about we don't like the core curriculum, we don't want to teach the core curriculum in English. We don't want to teach the core curriculum in math. We don't want to teach the core curriculum in science. We don't want to teach the core curriculum in English. Now, if Joe Blow in Tennessee is teaching core curriculum, Clive and Bundy in Texas is not teaching it, the people in Tennessee are going to get the college, and the people in Texas are going to be just like we said, Governor Perry said, whoops. I mean, because everybody needs to learn on the same level for everybody to compete on the same level.
Everyone needs to have access on the same level.
Yeah.
People will learn on different levels, higher or lower, but they need to have access and availability
access
to learn.
Thing. They need to have access to the same thing. Now, how it's taught is different because everybody is not taught the same way. I mean, you know, some people can listen. Some people have to write, which was me. I had to write. Some people don't have to do either. Like my brother, he could sit there and he just absorbed it. He was a genius. But, hey, there's other things he was a problem with, too. But the thing is that there is different levels of how people learn, but they have to be able to learn the same thing in order to compete. And, you know, if I know about the daggone, what we were talking about before, about carbon dating, and no one has even heard of the word carbon dating, I have an advantage. Mm-hmm. And this is where we're at. This is where we are today. And when you say that these people told you that, oh, I reject that. I don't want to be coached about nothing. What is the problem? Well, did you ask this person what that problem was? Delusion?
Me? Yeah. Yes, I'm still here.
Did you ask that person?
No, I didn't, because what I said, I did not ask why they said. Mm-hmm. I just explained why people have experienced coaching and counseling in a positive way and how it has affected me and my clients, and that with just and I explained it in that a mediator mediating your thoughts, the way that you're processing your own thoughts, which people don't realize what they say and think sometimes, but a mediator processing your thoughts and helping you to come from a point of being stuck to making that turn is valuable. It's completely valuable to move out of your own way. And sometimes, most times, we need someone to assist us with that, to help us with that. We have our girlfriends. We have our spouses. And that's great. And a lot of times, that's a great way to go. But sometimes, you don't want to share specific things. You can't share things about your friend to your friend. You can't share things about your spouse to your spouse. And sometimes you need somebody to help you make it make sense, to help you balance your day, to help you balance your mind. You know, it takes work, it takes effort, and why not have someone help you with that, to make it all clear and to make sense?
Well, doesn't it work also, you know, like Don Corleone did to the singer? He grabs him and he says, stop it, and act like a man. I mean, you know, sometimes that works. No?
Sometimes, I'm telling you, sometimes I have a client who needs to hear things gently, who needs to be nudged. And sometimes I have a client who needs to be
with Jack on,
and shook.
Oh, what?
So it's the person, and I have to gauge that.
Okay.
But I'm not going to put a gun through the phone.
Well, the thing you mean you don't go 24 on them and you know and Jack pull a Jack on them and say, hey, you know who I am, right? No, but the thing is now, all right. Now, what do most people have a problem with coaching? Or is there such a thing as that?
Yes. They have a problem with, there's two type of people that have a problem with coaching. One, the person who likes a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a counselor, a medical degree that says 20 years of school and they sit across and they're in an office and they have a practice and there's people and they think that's just it. And so they are against coaching because the coaching, although I've had to train for hours on end, months on end, years on end, to learn about different aspects of life, to learn about coaching, you have to be certified. Some coaches aren't certified. They are against the notion that there's someone else that has been trained to do what it took a doctor 20 years to do. And so they're rejecting it. But what they're not seeing is the new task and ideas and challenges that a life coach is open for that a psychiatrist may not be open for. The other ones are afraid of coaching because, and it happens quite frequently in the African-American community, we don't believe that we should have somebody from outside come inside and help us. We're just going to stay and be messed up on our own. And that happens quite frequently. So, you know, it's those two dynamics. It's the one who want to reject progression in a different way. And then there's the one who just through ignorance and what history has said and that kind of thing or what the parents have said, but just say, yeah, nope, not going to work. And it's unfortunate in both departments because you should be open to new experiences and you should try whatever there is for you to try. And then if it doesn't work, then you can make your decision based on actual knowledge.
Okay, but now you
go again with that knowledge. So.
That's
the problem.
See, the problem is, do you find that so many people don't like coaching because they say, "Hey, you think you know more than me?"
That happens too, and I know that with you got the scientists. The thing is, I don't proclaim to know more than you, and I as a coach am not here.
Wait. You did not go see them. They came to see you.
No,
so
I don't proclaim to know more than you. What I do say is, I am able to help you understand where you are and help you get to where you want to go. And that has nothing to do with if I know banking or I know engineering or I know how to flip a burger. It doesn't change. The person doesn't change how I coach them. And I'm coaching through where you are and where you want to go. And I don't need to know what you do at work. I need to know how you respond at work, how you work at work. I need to help you be a better you. And that has nothing to do with me knowing how to run your job. I can help you help yourself be more clear so that you can see the path and where you need to go to get further, to be unstuck. A lot of people just stuck. They're just stuck for no reason. And just it's comfortable sometimes. It's comfortable. And there's that fear. What if I put my foot out and step out? What will happen? And sometimes you need somebody to help give you a nudge. That's not your mama or your daddy or, you know, your sister or your uncle. You need somebody who is an outsider who says, you know, you have something there. You're valuable. You mean something to this world. You can do this. And it could be simple as, do I want a bologna sandwich today? Why? What does a bologna sandwich mean to you? I mean, do you have to have it? I mean, it's just simple. It just doesn't have to be large problems. It can be simple problems. I have a client that calls at 7 in the morning before they go to work just to get a good head on, clear, and they shook some of that dust off from last week, and they're not going into work angry. And they can be open to whatever's going on. And we need that.
Yeah. I'm going to put my microphone in my mouth. Anyway, the thing is,
were you eating up what I was saying? You were eating up what I was saying. You put the microphone in your mouth.
Along with some pretzels. I was eating up what you said.
Yeah, well, you know, we've already lost one president.
That's right.
Let's not lose you.
All right.
I think some people, and maybe it's just a conservative mindset, they're much more afraid of change. They're less open. They don't like anything new. They don't want change. And I do think that there's a large bit of the fear of introspection she was talking about. You know, something hidden or something may come out that you don't want to talk about. So I think there's a lot of reasons that drive people away. But, again, it doesn't make it any less valid. The fact that you're scared to talk about something or don't want to address something doesn't make it invalid. So I think everybody could use a lot of help and a lot of growing up in this country. And if you think – this is one of my pet peeves – people who think that they're already done, that they know everything, that they have been fully formed and informed in life, are the ones in the most need of help.
Are you talking about me?
Yes.
No, I agree. I'll give you a high five. I completely concur with that point.
You agree with him? He's talking about me? What is this?
That point, too.
Now, wait a minute here. This is about... But before we go to David, to ask you a question here, how does this show out? More women or more men come for coaching?
To be honest, it's more women. I think.
Rest my case.
Yeah.
Yes. And I mean, and that speaks to, because I'm sorry, men on this call, you don't think you need to be told and guided on how to do things, and you think you got to figure it all out, and you know, you would benefit, the men would benefit so much from being open to help.
Oh, I need some Grey Goose, and that's it. And I can solve anything. That's it.
Grey Goose, my
open wound. David, we have David Adams on the phone right now. David, do you have a question to ask Valerie about how inappropriate it is for men to get coaching?
To get what?
To get coaching. Life coaching. Life coaching.
Life coaching?
Yes.
I think David has a different question.
Yes.
You can always, you know, throw up the old pseudo macho syndrome, how unmasculine that is for a guy, you know, to have to go to a female for something, you know, of that nature. But you know, we live in the new modern world. You know, women are supposed to be just as qualified in a lot of areas that are traditionally been, you know, labeled as areas for men. So I mean,
right.
I don't think that's unrealistic kind of situation. I mean, it depends on the situation. If the sister's got something, you know, that she can deliver that can help him, you know what I mean? I mean, I don't think it looks very masculine or very macho, but hey, you know, we live in a different society.
I have male counterparts as well, and they too, their numbers for men are very low. So it's really not, from my perspective,
about coming to a woman, although there's that level there too. But as a whole, they're not, the men are just not coming for help from anyone, from my perspective, and then the people that I'm around and work with. So, and it's unfortunate. I wish that more would come and have more than book knowledge, and I love the man and the male instincts. I love some of the things that they think instinctively and they feel instinctively. It's the way that they were made, and it's great. But we can all use guidance. I'm going to use that word, guidance. And I think to over time that will
change.
Why
don't you just say thing? I mean, well, what's this? I need a coach. I got a coach here. She tells you the same thing. You need guidance. Every day she says that. I mean, give me a break here.
Maybe there's a recurrent message in your life.
A recurrent message in my life? I mean, come on
all
now.
Right, so here's my final question.
Yes.
Where does a life coach go for coaching?
Ah.
A life coach goes to another life coach.
Goes to a husband.
No, my husband does not want to coach me because I won't listen to him because he's my husband. But
you see?
A life coach. it is the smartest of life coaches that have life coaches. And because everyone needs the support. It's not a dentist, you know, goes to another dentist to get their teeth fixed. So it's just it's something that I must have and that I think life coaches should have. And there are life coaches that don't. They just wing it. And I don't think that you can be as clear for yourself and for others if you're just not clear for yourself.
Well, before we go on here,
like Tom Cruise, you need
a wingman. Need a wingman.
Yeah.
Before we go on here, we have coming in Dr. Grace Lee.
How are you? Hello, Michael.
She's drowning in her own.
That's what the talk theme.
Yeah.
You don't talk
your
own theme.
So I was listening to this segment of this, Valerie, and it was great, and really great. And, you know, she's so on point on so many things, how important it is to have a life coach, particularly for, I mean, you know, I'm not going to say that every single person, I don't know that every single person in the whole wide world has access to a life coach. A professional, an absolute life coach in name, but we all do. If you think back and you look at it, we've all had life coaches, our mamas, our grandmamas, you know. But if you step back and think about it again, the majority of our informal life coaches have been women. They've been your mama or your grandmama. I mean, my daddy was my life coach too, but he was rare among men. Because my daddy had a feminine side that he embraced, you know, but very few men do that.
Yeah, well,
she is spot on. She's spot on.
I have two women telling me what to do all my life. I don't know what to do. Then I had two girls what to do.
But think about how much better you could have done it had you had somebody to coach you through it. You could have done it with less stress.
Michael, listen, you just have to learn, look, you just have to learn two words. Are you ready?
Okay.
Yes,
dear.
That's right. Yes, sir. That's right. Hey, I got that down pat.
Yes, dear.
And then I take another drink. I mean, what?
Yeah. You know, Mike, sometimes
that's right. It does. You know, the only thing I'm not wearing is the high heels. Listen, Valerie... Where can, if people want to get in contact with you...
Because if you can survive Mike, you can help anyone.
I think I've guided Michael Arthur a little bit along the way myself. I don't know if I should own that or not, but
her mother did. Her mother did. Her mother.
my practice, I do conference call only. For me, my clients are in New York, they're in Georgia, they're in California. The what I have found is that people are more open to say more when someone's not staring at them. And when people can decide in their head what the person looks like. So I can decide in my head what appeals to me. And I can listen to that person now with that in my mind. So, and then when I have to leave the country or go out of town, I don't have to miss my standing appointment because I can be anywhere in the world to have a phone call. And well, so for me,
I saw that very Criminal Minds where the person was talking to, and it didn't work out that well because they found out where they were. They were. They hacked them and traced them, tracked them down.
Oh, now, come on.
Anyway, I
haven't had anyone track me down, but I think it's worked so far, and I've been doing it since 2001. My phone number for people to contact me, I'm at 774-BEING-88, which translates to 234-6488, and my email is Valerie Thomas, V-A-L-E-R-I-E, Thomas, T-H-O-M-A-S, at the number 88, MOC.com. And I have a Facebook page that I love to use and interact with for positive images and positive dialogue, and that's on Facebook, and that's facebook.com/88MOC, the number 88, M-O-C. And that's a great place to come on and look at some stuff and like it and share it. It's all positive. It's nothing that's going to send you into a bad day. Some of it's a little funny, but there's nothing that's going to be risque or bad. It's going to be something that you might need that day.
Oh, you're not fun at all then. Jeez,
forget that. Anyway. I thought I could imagine this in my mind.
Yeah.
What kind of call is it?
Break it.
No, seriously, I just want to know, 88 M-O-C, C-O-M.
M-O-U-S-E. No.
That's an 8, and an 8 is a mirror of itself. M-O-C
I'm glad I went to,
is a mirror of C-O-M.
Right.
What is this duality? This is duality mirror imaging in your life. Can you explain that, please?
So that's so – you're going to take everything to science, and I'm not. I'm not going to go with you to science on the number 88.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you that – the number 88
– can I pick up the answer for you, Valerie? In Asian culture, in Chinese, that number 8 is good luck. So you have 2 8.
There's my answer.
Good luck. There you go.
Good luck. That's my answer.
There
good luck.
And that's true because I carry a little 2-inch square piece of paper with the number 8 on it in my wallet.
Mm-hmm.
I was told to do that.
Mm-hmm. And do you
good
have good luck?
Hey,
and
give me a break here.
The symbol of infinity.
Every woman I ever met has told me what to do. So, hey, we more told.
Oy vey.
All right.
Yeah,
and
this is 88 is significant for me.
Right. And to be... To have everything come out in light, Valerie is a relative of mine, my cousin.
Oh.
So, yeah, well, hey, I've been doing it. Don't matter. But thank you, Valerie, for giving us your time.
And putting up with us.
And putting up with us, yes.
You're welcome. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Say hello
thank
to your
you.
Father.
Bye, Valerie. You too.
Everybody else.
All right,
and,
bye-bye.
Yes, bye-bye.
I will. Bye-bye.
So,
you didn't get the memo, Mike.
I didn't get
the memo. You're supposed to have a life coach that's not related to you. So
oh, is that right?
You can get help and be honest.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, so
there you go again. Failing the
memo. I don't want to get – listen, hey, they didn't tell me that. I mean, the woman didn't tell me that. I didn't know. So,
right. Well, you know what I love about Dr. Green?
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
He's so smart that even when I try in my hardest to confuse and confound and just – basically, screw with everybody.
Right.
She still pulled it out and had the best answer of the day.
That's true.
She even brought in ancient Chinese. secrets. I love it. Well, okay, that's cool. That's a great rule.
David, what's can you give us any update on Shannon DeMotti?
Unfortunately, Michael, I don't have any update for him. We were supposed to get some documents, but unfortunately there were some logistic issues this past weekend that are supposed to be corrected this weekend. But for the most part, the case is pretty much just on ice.
Well, but it's better than it was a month ago because he's out of the in harm's way, I would assume.
Yeah, he's no longer being detained at the Franklin County Detention Center. I mean, I guess that's got to be some kind of, a situation where the kid's going to be treated a little better and I guess gives his family a little bit of relief because he wasn't being allowed to make phone calls, kept in solitary confinement for most of his stay there. Now he's able to interact with the other inmates. He's living in a dormitory. He's been able to make phone calls and actually receive visits. So, yeah, it's definitely a better situation for him now.
Has there been any evaluation of him, of his mental state, of his emotional state? Does he seem to have weathered it well, or is he half broken, or what? Do we know?
No, I actually spoke to him. His mother called me when she had him on the phone once, and I actually spoke to Shannon for the first time. I've been writing about this kid's case for roughly 7 or 8 months now, and it was a privilege to get to actually speak to him. And he sounded very strong. He sounded very positive. He struck me as a very humble young man, very respectful. Everything, he answered every question with yes, sir, and to his mother, yes, ma'am. A very respectful kid. I think I told Mike Lawson that after speaking to this young man, I became even more convinced of his innocence, without even looking at the merits of his case.
That's good news, though.
That's good. Getting to the VA, Dr. Grace, I want to know why we have, during the years prior to Afghanistan and Iraq, where we cut out hundreds of doctors, cut back thousands, billions of dollars that went to helping VA injured vets, and then all of a sudden we get a massive influx of people that have served 7, 8, 9, and 10 tours of duty. Right now I think it's over 1 million people, soldiers, and we don't have enough doctors, we don't have enough nurses, even though, we don't have enough money, and we're going to get to that, why they expected the VA not to have a problem.
Precisely. And also, let's not forget that they have done, these very people that are pointing fingers at Eric Shinseki and that are demanding his resignation, are the very people that have, at every given opportunity, defunded the VA, okay? As much as they possibly could, they really have. They have denied veterans their benefits. And so when I was listening to these morons demanding Erickson, two Democrats, too, by the way, and they ought to be ashamed of themselves, I expect that of all the Republicans demanding Erickson Shinseki to resign. But I do not expect any Democrats to join that cabal. And that is absolutely shameful. Because Eric Shinseki not only is an honorable person, he's the only person that's got enough smart and got enough brains and got enough patience and love of the veterans to sit there and take this crap from them and continue to work hard. The worst thing that can happen is that Eric Shinseki does resign. That would be the worst thing that can happen for the VA. The worst. Okay, but these fools are playing political games. That's what they're doing.
Well the thing I don't understand... Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, what I'm saying is that these are people who have blocked every measure for helping the VA.
That's right.
And I want to put something from Tom Hartman that he quoted the other day. Just listen to this.
The Republicans have their strategy and they're sticking to it, even though it involves destroying lives and even killing people. It's working so well because of a simple statistical reality. The majority of Americans, depending on which survey you look at, between 65 and 70%, cannot name which political party controls the House of Representatives, which party controls the Senate, or either. Because most Americans don't know who controls Congress when Congress misbehaves, as they've been doing for the last 6 years, most Americans aren't sure which party to blame. Out of the Republican chaos strategy based entirely on this statistical and political reality. And common sense suggests that well over 90% of Americans know that Barack Obama is the president and that he's incompetent. Republicans know this too, and it's the other half of their strategy. Therefore, what Republicans know is that if they can cause damage to the American economy and to the American working people, they're not realizing it was exclusively they are going to assume that the president and the Democratic Party is a member of, must be a member of, or even bears all of the responsibility. No, to burn the country, damage the country, and you damage the Democratic Party. Just as in the midterm election in general, for 6 years now, Republicans have been hard at work.
They removed taxes
for big companies to move jobs overseas.
Now, this was the lead up to what that we needed to know the background to this whole problem with the VA. Now, here's Tom Armand again.
Climate change.
Yeah, I don't agree with the notion that some are putting out there, including scientists, that somehow there are actions we can take today that would actually have an impact on what's happening in our climate. Our climate is always changing.
But let me get this straight. You do not think that human activity, the production of CO2, has caused warming to our planet?
I do not believe that human activity is causing these dramatic changes to our climate the way these scientists are portraying it. That's what I do not, and I do not.
Long cut, Michael.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Well,
yes,
I'm okay.
Okay, Mike was off there. What I was saying is that I had the mic cut off there for a minute.
Yeah.
It was the wrong cut.
Well,
we were talking about climate change earlier, and that's what was queued up. But point is the same. So you've got these people who are doing everything they can actively to destroy or hinder the government, but then they turn around and blame the president for said problems. It's the same way, though, with the embassy thing. They want investigations of Benghazi, but then they had, you know, count of 8 different attacks and bombings of embassies under Bush, and they demanded 0 investigation.
So we have, you know, we have a brilliant, you talk about the VA, under Eric Shinseki, we've had more response to veterans' claims and veterans' problems than under any other secretary of the VA. Seriously.
Exactly.
Okay,
but they're doing real harm because they just got Shinseki's tough guy. What was his name? The guy's resigned. I mean, they had to resign due to a firestorm.
But the thing is, though, why is the American Legion?
Okay. Not Kevin Henretta. Kevin Henretta just resigned, did he? It's not Kevin Henretta, right?
Three people just resigned. But the question I have, why Thomas
Robert,
up?
Robert Petzl just resigned, Undersecretary.
Well, why is the American Legion want Shinseki to resign?
That's a real question. and I have said this all along, every person that I have met that belongs to the American Legion is a rabid Republican, even Tea Party people in that group. And that's sad. That's sad, because they're putting politics again before. They can't see that Giuseppe is doing everything he can. They can't see that we're doing, that the entire VA, everyone that works with Giuseppe is doing everything that they can. All
right?
The VA system in and of itself is a dinosaur. It is archaic. It is tough to manage because the majority of the people that work for the VA, petty bureaucrats. In order to really affect change, you have to change the system of the VA, which is what, you know, it's the process, right? You have to change the system, which is what Shinseki has been working on and doing. And he's been doing this in his wonderful, very kind, very patient way.
Right.
But and, he didn't come in and fire everybody.
Michael, I actually think the problem's a little bit broader. I really think the problem's a little broader than what we've been saying. I mean, there's a lot of political debating going on between the two political parties in terms of you know, the support and criticism of the president. But I think what American citizens fail to realize is that as a country, we are essentially broke. Okay,
yeah.
our debt is just astronomical. And we're in a position right now of actually being unseated as the trade dollar, okay, in the world market, okay? And once that happens, okay, the life as we know it in the United States is going to be gone forever, okay, until we find some kind of way to reinvent ourselves to get us back on top of the economic market. Now, everybody's complaining about the VA, but, you know, the VA is just taking its hits just like every other federal agency. You know, and I think that we're forgetting to talk about the debt that this country has, you know, across the globe.
Yeah, but you see, I'm in complete, 80% disagreement with that. The reason why we are in broke is because every 33 of the Republican governors in this state have cut their taxes and are now running at major deficits in this country because they did not want Barack Obama to succeed. These people would rather the whole country go down the tube than one black man succeed in this country. That's the problem. We would not have that if we had, like we did in the Eisenhower era, where we put tens of millions of people to work on works projects. They don't want that because we wouldn't have a debt. We wouldn't have a problem. They don't want it.
Yeah, a lot of that's true. A lot of that's true. And what the Republicans are doing are just exacerbating the situation. Okay, you have to remember we had a tremendous debt way before Barack Obama even began to run for the presidency.
Yeah, but wait a minute. No. You got to figure out why we didn't have a debt when Clinton was in office. The debt came when Bush came in office.
We got two wars.
Because we had two wars, we had an unpaid two wars that were not paid for, and we had a medical program Part D that wasn't paid for, and he cut everybody who's a multi-billionaire's taxes. This was their whole plan, to run the country in the ground so we could kill Medicare and Social Security. That's their program.
Which gets back to that drowned in the pool.
That's right. They said this before. We're going to drown Medicare and Social Security in the drowning pool. They do not. That's right. See, when we came into office, when George Bush came into office, he had an $800 billion surplus. And in 8 years, it was like $4 trillion deficit.
Mm-hmm.
And he left 150,000 jobs a month losing. He was losing that a month. I mean, this
irrespect to how it transpired, and I agree with you, I would say 90%, Michael, in terms of what Bush did, because he fought two wars, you know, pretty much, you know, back to back.
Which he created, David. He created, you know, he fought two wars of his choice, okay?
Sure.
Of his choice. And it was they were not wars we should have gone into. They were absolutely, I will never, you know, there are certain things that I say, I always never do absolute, but I'm going to do an absolute, okay? There are certain people I will never forgive. Bush, Cheney, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, McNamara, LBJ, I will never forgive them for getting this country, for lying this country into war. That doesn't happen.
I like LBJ, but he sure screwed up that Vietnam because I was over there.
Good afternoon.
And you too. Grace.
Good afternoon.
Yes.
Good afternoon.
And we
good afternoon.
Are joined with
Hi.
I was trying to wait to get a good talking point to get you in, Abigail, but you are here.
Sometimes you can have to jump like that.
Well,
because
you know what?
The reason is because I wanted to lead you into this, since you are a person that is a person who conducts commentary, and you also lecture people on the various aspects of what they need to do. Now,
Yes, sir. I'm sorry,
Hello?
Say that again, sir.
There you go,
Michael. Yes. I just thought it's Miss Abigail Motes, the communication expert, international orator, Empower consultant, and I'm listening to you all, spirited intellectuals, and I said, well, there's no way that if I don't say something, it's not going to happen. But I have enjoyed your commentary.
Now the thing is, since you are a speaker and an orator on various things, what we were saying about where we were at, and I understand that, is your husband in the military?
No, not currently.
But anyway, the thing is that, how do you get someone like George Bush, Dick Cheney, Rumsfeld to talk a whole country into going to war when it didn't happen?
Well, I think what's interesting is people support their agendas that they believe in. And when you have a group or a conglomerate, in a vernacular sense, we would say a posse of like-minded individuals. You have the Bush-Cheney era that was extremely supportive of one another's agenda. They, you know, raised children together. They shared the same golf and country club. They shared the same politics and ideology. So, and that was all about, you know, increasing their revenue dollars, making sure that their oil wells and their rigs were taken care of, and that their trust funds were in place. All of those things spoke to their interests. They didn't have the common people or persons' plight at the forefront of their mind. And so when you have a force like the 1% in this country who have the political and financial ability to make things happen, people that have that type of power collectively can assert and insert whatever agenda is of passion to them. So for them to have taken us into the Gulf and the Iraq wars, it supported their causes. You know, the fact that it was stated that Saddam Hussein had offended senior George Bush, and junior George Bush had to get him back because he insulted his daddy. You know, that was the long-running thought process why they went in and just murdered and killed that man and, you know, looted and raided his country many years ago. And there seemed to be support for all of those wars. But, you know, with the new agenda, with the fact that you do have a man of African descent, quite literally, and you have him trying to look out for the common interest of commoners, you know, the bottom heavy percentage that don't necessarily have the ability to write the checks, you know, without blinking for the agendas and causes that really care about the plight of the American people, that didn't serve well, that 1%. So, you know, race plays a tremendous factor, but then you have to look at the economic power that if everyone became level, there would be no distinction. So certainly our country is not fond of socialism at large. We are a capitalistic society. Our country loves the opportunity to be distinct and distinguished in their wealth and their assets and the accumulation of their assets. You know, I'm also a financial services professional, so I sit with some of those top-earning millionaires and help them strategize and plan. So I can see both sides of the benefit. But certainly when you have a current president like President Barack Obama, who is committed to the agenda of helping not only people become economically sound, but actually helping a healthcare agenda that has been devoid and has been lacking equality for some time, you know, you're going to get some pushback because it involves a new social arena. It involves leveling the playing field. People that couldn't afford a doctor can now go to amongst the best doctors when that was reserved for the top 1%. So I see it as more of a dichotomy of, you know, the haves and have-nots and those who want to maintain it and make certain that they have not never really obtained it in a traditional manner. So I think that that really becomes the color. It becomes a have or have nots because we have 1%ers that are of brown descent, and they have expressed passion in being more generous in their taxation to fund some of these interests. But by and large, you have a true separation of the haves and have nots. Did I answer your question, Michael?
No. Here's the reason why. Because you keep mentioning that 1%. That means why and how does the 99% get talked into doing something against their own self-interest?
Well, because the power of influence, you know, marketing, media, it's the most powerful force in our world, in fact, because we've derived many of our images and ideologies from pictures that have been circulated around the world. Everybody thought that all that was in Africa were people in backwoods, you know, scratching themselves with tiki huts and, you know, straw. But when the new images have emerged of a vibrant South Africa and vibrant West Africa places, we know that there's some unrest civilly. But by and large, there's a tremendous amount of wealth. You have even the black billionaire woman that is an African woman. So what I'm saying is the media will paint whatever picture they want the mainstream to believe, and who has run traditionally the media. You've got Rupert Murdoch. You've got all of these people that have been able to have longstanding appeal, longstanding influence, and longstanding impact throughout our world, and with social media and the unitedness of our entire country, images circulate within seconds, and they change the trajectory of history in many instances. World fractions and all of those things are now able to be challenged in milliseconds via Twitter, via Facebook. And so that's why I believe that the 99% can go along very well with this, is because they've always been told what they should think. And that is what people have given into. And I know it sounds kind of incredulous. People just, oh, I'm an independent thinker. Well, people aren't as independent as they say. that because they are influenced right readily. That's why some people didn't believe that, you know, African Americans were beautiful in this country because of the fact that they had blonde hair and blue eyes as a mainstream force that was being purported all over this world. So that impacted not only black people or persons in America, that impacts Asians who dye their skin and dye their hair blonde. And so that kind of imagery, that kind of influence, that kind of impact has continued to have an effect on our culture overall, and it spreads into the economic support measures as well. People support what they believe in.
Okay, well, with all the, and I understand what you're saying, which is the answer that I was really looking for, you hit it on the nose, but what I'm trying to say is, with all the other ways we can find out information today, why are they still being influenced? I mean, it's almost like who you believe, me or your own lying eyes?
Mm. Wow.
Is that what we're saying?
I believe so. It's very interesting. You know, the experiment, what you just brought me to, Michael, is the doll experiment that was done initially in the late 70s, maybe even early 80s. And, you know, those that are, I'm sure many are saying yes. What'd you say, sir?
It was earlier than that.
But that doll, in the 60s, I didn't have the exact date in front of me, but certainly. But the biggest point of this is that doll experiment was reconducted about a year ago, okay? So what seemed hard to believe that these black girls would be given these black dolls, and then they would also be given the white dolls, and they would be told to say, who did you believe, or which of these do you believe are beautiful, right?
Right.
So without fail, the brown, beautiful girls chose the white dolls. And when they said, well, which do you believe is not beautiful? And they were given the brown dolls and looked at them and said, this one that looks like me. And so to your point, do you believe me or you're lying? Fast forward to 2013 or 2012 when the experiment was reconducted, and with all of the what we consider progression, with an African-American president, with the African-American first lady, you know, all of this exposure, that same experiment still had the same impact. More times out of 10, I think it was four out of five times, the brown girls chose the white dolls again to connote their belief of what is beautiful. And so I'm telling you that imagery is powerful. But what is really powerful is when we have independent thinkers like yourself who don't stop yelling and crying out in the wilderness, because at some point change happens. It happens often as a microcosm first, and it gets a little attention, and then it gets a lot more energy, and then it becomes a groundswell, and then it becomes a movement. And so I used to think, because I started being a professional speaker at 14, ironically, to other teens, and I was teaching postponing sexual involvement through a series. So I did that throughout high school and early into college, and I would have to go in and talk about self-esteem, and I would have to go in and teach these people, that young people, that, you know, your body's so precious, nobody deserves to have it until you desire to give it away. And just trying to change the mindsets of people who have not been further reinforced in their homes, it's interesting. So it starts at home, but if the parents have not been loved, if the parents have not generationally been inspired, you have perpetual issues. You have generational issues that continue to manifest themselves and perpetuate themselves in gruesome ways. But I'm hopeful. I used to think I was called to change the whole world. But then I got clarity and revelation as I got older that, oh, no, I'm just supposed to change the people that I have been divinely called to assist. And so with you, Mr. Lawson, having your power, Michael, that you've had all these years, you have an audience that has been shifted. And so that is the power that we have individually, but then I believe that there are like minds that always find each other. Just the amazing way that you and I became connected,
yeah.
That every impact that we make is significant. And it doesn't look like much in the beginning, but it's also seen over time and in generations. And I believe with all of the dark things that we still see, all of the racism in government, all the disrespect, I still believe we're a generation closer to even more greatness, to even more change. That's my true belief.
Well, yeah, I got a question for you then. How do we convince the people that when a tree falls in the forest and there's no one around, it still makes a noise?
You said, what do we do with those people? Say that one more time, please.
How do you convince these same people that when a tree falls in the forest and there's no one around, it still makes a noise?
You know, like I stated, it's very interesting. We didn't, I know that as a country and a nation, I mean, I think we all pinched ourselves, you know, the night that he was elected, I believe it was September 4, 2008. I could be slightly off with the date. But I think
November.
What am I talking about? My birthday is November 1st. I vote every year. I apologize profusely. I don't know why September is in my mind. November, thank you so much. November 2008, we all pinched ourselves that night because we didn't believe that would happen. And, you know, we still are going through some challenges. We are still going through some transition through this process. But I guess the biggest point is the tree that, you know, declared change would come started way back in slavery. It started, you know, with Harriet Tubman doing Underground Railroad, you know, deeds and duties and just taking on tasks, you know, all of Frederick Douglass and all the ways that they implemented educational change. There are always changes that are occurring, and it takes some time, like a water, you get a drop of water, but then it has a rippling effect, and sometimes it's slow in the beginning, and then it gets to the point of building up momentum, and it becomes a current, it becomes a wave, and then it begins to rush over an area. So with that stated, every tree in the forest that looks like no one's listening, there is an impact, and I know that we are closer than ever to some real change. It's gradual. It won't look like what we think all the time, but believe you me, if you're making noise, your point was heard, and whether or not they accept you today, they can't deny you forever, and more than that, they can't generationally deny you, because what is destined for you is coming. And our greatness is yet in progress in this country. It's looking bleak. The gentleman stated that we're losing our economic status. China has become such a global force that they can push a button and turn all the lights off in America. That's how much in debt we are to America. And when all the labels that used to have somebody else's name says made in China and everybody's kind of bowed down to that, you know, that's pretty interesting. But I'm hopeful that there's going to be some amazing innovators to change the global scale very shortly now. And I already know some groups that are working on some economic changes. So it's happening. It's happening.
David, what do you have to add to that?
Well, she makes some excellent points. I agree with her. You know,
Thank you, sir.
Very, very empowering. You know, one thing I wanted to just drop back to, Michael, when she was talking about how, you know, the president's created these two particular wars for their own agenda, I think she kind of missed out the fact that those agendas were all economic, okay?
Absolutely.
Not economic agendas that would have benefited the country, but economic agendas that benefited individuals in power, okay, like Dick Cheney, who was a part of the board of directors of Halliburton. Okay,
oh, yeah.
whose company manufactured a lot of the weapons that are used, okay, and who a lot of the contractors that went over there to clean up the country after the fact. So you're talking about individuals in government who had the power and the authority to not only create the wars but benefited on the back end after the country was destroyed. So she made some excellent points. I just would like to hear, you know, I wish she had expounded more on that, the personal agendas that were accomplished, not the political agendas for a particular party, but for the personal individuals.
Yes. And is this David? Are you David speaking? Okay, sir. Well, actually, I did allude to that early on. I don't know if you heard it as such, when I mentioned the fact that, you know, Bush and Cheney and all of those guys, remember I said they were raising their children together. They had agendas that were in their best interest. I told you that, you know, because of the fact that they have oil wells, some even over there in Saudi Arabia that people didn't know about, they were protecting their interests. Not to mention Texas, they've got that on lock, and they've got some in Florida as well. But they had international oil wells that they were looking to take authority over again. They trained, you won't have to help me. Who's the one that just got annihilated by President Obama 2 years ago? Saddam Hussein, Bin Laden. He was trained in the United States. They trained him. And what I'm trying to communicate, that they will do what is beneficial to them at that moment to please their economic and financial interests. Economics, really, it rules the world. It really does in the sense that even for those that, you know, you don't even have to have a biblical belief in this, but the scripture says money answereth all things, materials, you know, and it has the ability to help people, make people change their mind if they're not convinced of their, you know, true passion and their conviction. A dollar with a nice zero or multiple zeros behind it will change most people's minds. So to your point, Halliburton, and you've got Warren Buffett. He just happens to have a disposition of quality within him. He's about the earnings. That's why he and Bill Gates have stayed at the top of the financial earnings charts. He has a little compassion, so he gives some interest. But by and large, capitalism is funded by their interest, and so it's never short of economic impact. It's never short. And that is why I said to you the color is green. And if you have, you know, they mix their positions, but Oprah can get invited to some places just because she can write a check, not because they like her so much. Does that make sense?
Is that like Magic Johnson? Is that like Magic Johnson? Magic Johnson? Yes.
With the Donald Sterling event, oh my God! Well, you know, I think there's some gradients of black acceptance. I think there's some gradients of black acceptance. Wouldn't you all agree?
Absolutely.
I would like to chime in on the tree analogy. Okay, I would like to chime in on the tree analogy. The people who do not believe that the tree makes the sound even when there's no one around belong to this amazing organization known as the Flat Earth Society, and we all know them. So trying to change that kind of a mind is like beating your head up against a brick wall. And there comes a time when you have to say, no, this hurts too damn much. I'm not going to do it anymore. And I'm not. I'm not going to do it anymore. You will, you know, I agree that we should certainly reach out and try to help people and try to pull them along. But again, there comes a time, I say this to my patients, I will not work harder than you in the road to getting you to good health. So if I am working too darn hard and you're not doing anything, I stop working. That's
absolutely
it. Because you personally have to take that responsibility. So,
absolutely,
while, you know, yes, maybe down the road, and I'm sure down the road, the impact, if you talk philosophically, the impact, you know, if a butterfly flaps its wings in Brazil, the impact is up here. The butterfly is like, yes, indeed, if you talk about that philosophically. But if you're talking about concrete measures and you're talking about, you know, well, how do we change these people that, you know, believe that when the tree falls in the forest that makes no sound,
The answer is you can't. You can't.
That's right.
They will change themselves. You can't.
Well, we have another caller. Caller 5560. Hello. Who's this? Anybody listening? Okay.
Well,
Abigail.
Well, Doctor, to your point, you know, I perceived the way that Michael brought that point out to be a little different. I mean, with you being a practitioner in health, I think the biggest point was individual responsibility in that you are the tree, and that's what I'm trying to communicate is the fact that, let me give you the example that I teach to people about, and actually Bishop Noel Jones, I don't know if you all are familiar with him, he's Grace Jones's brother, but he's a well-known minister. He brought this example out. I've given my perspective, but I'll share with you his that has made a significant impact on my processing. He states that we all are going to have an impact, right? But there are some people, like I was telling you earlier, I'm called to a certain audience. You, doctor, have patients that are called to you. Michael has a tremendous audience that's called to him. And those people, everybody has a container, okay? So you can take a cup, right? You can take a cup of water and fill it up. You can set that cup of water next to a jar and fill it up. You can set that jar of water next to a basin, a wide basin. You can fill that basin up with water. You can set that basin of water next to a lake and fill that basin up, that lake up. You can set that lake next to a river and fill that river up. And then you can set that river next to an ocean and fill that up. The thing is, each of these containers held their maximum capacity, okay? So it doesn't matter that the cup could only hold this much and that the ocean contained so much more. The fact is each of them were vessels that were beneficial and could be utilized for whatever the purpose was at that time. Each of us are containers. Each of us have divine capacity. And my measure is not your measure. Your measure is not my measure. And it's not for us to be small-minded and wasteful of energy and time, the resource that we cannot retrieve, to spend futile arguments and debates over who's better because I'm a ocean and somebody else is a water basin on a sink. It's the point that we are all operating at our maximum capacity in this time that we have.
That's
is the point
analogy
about the tree. Yeah, well, thank you, sir.
That is a great analogy. But I believe,
thank
like
you,
the doc was saying, you know, the culture that we have who all thought that the earth was flat, you know, and you utilize that juxtaposed to what Michael was saying about the people who don't realize that once a tree falls, it still, you know, it still makes a noise, still makes a sound. I believe that the American people have reached that plateau, because if you look at the, you know, all the different kinds of movements that were going on once we became on the same page that we were financially in trouble, we were in dire straits. You know, the different movements that were going on that are going on globally, actually. So I think that we are conforming as a people, not only just in this country but around the world. You know, in terms of the things that the 1% are doing and how the kinds of political decisions and the political things that they do utilizing public funding, okay, how it impacts us, and we get very little, you know, return for our tax dollars. You know, I think that we're more deserving of representation than that, better representation than that. You know, there's a lot of movements going around this country that are not traditional, that are anti-government, okay, that are anti 1%. So I think that, you know, I think everybody makes a great analogy, but like the lady is saying that, you know, no matter how small, once we get to the capacity where we're fed up with the kinds of things that are going on in the government, we're going to try to move on to a next phase to try to, you know, correct the situation. You know, so I just wanted to make that point. That was a great analogy.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Because, you know, there's that old wonderful adage,
you can take a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Right? That's wonderful. Or, as Dorothy Parker would say, because she was asked to make a sentence with the word horticulture, Dorothy Parker said, you can take a horticulture, but you can't make her think. Okay, a funny ha-ha. Well, you know, I thought I'd bring some levity into this. But the reality is, we all, you know, there's a maximum to what each one of us can do, given the time constraints and given the capacities that we have. Asking anyone to step out of that boundary and give more, I always challenge people to step out of their comfort zone consistently. I'm constantly challenging people to do that. I do it myself. I step out of my comfort zone consistently because that is the challenge to growth. That is how people grow. That's my personal belief now. I'm not going to tell everyone that this path is the same. It should be for everyone. But my personal belief is that every time I step out or I challenge myself to step out of my comfort zone and I deal with a particular problem, that it benefits not only, you know, people around me, hopefully, but most importantly, it benefits myself, okay? And it's my personal growth that I'm after. If you look at it from the whole Buddhist standpoint, it's always personal growth because you want to reach the point of complete enlightenment and nirvana. So that is where I'm coming from. But there comes a point in time where, again, the Flat Earth Society is the Flat Earth Society. There are 23% of people that, regardless of what you say, are going to believe that there's no climate change, are going to believe that, no, if they're not present, it didn't happen. You know, so the tree falling in the forest makes a noise. Yeah, didn't happen because I wasn't there. You know? There's that group of people. And with that group of people, you just have to shrug your shoulders and go, fine.
Whatever.
You put me in. I'm sorry. Was someone else going to speak? This is Abigail. Is someone else was someone else going to say something? You made me think of something, Doctor, when you said that.
Yeah.
You know, were you saying something, Michael? Okay.
Right.
To your point, I think it's very interesting. I think this is my takeaway. Is that once more, you have people that are always going to be agents of change, you know, destined to be change agents. And I think, you know, nobody knew that Marcus Garvey was going to be able to do what he did in his time frame, that, you know, all of these people through generations, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, all of these people, you can't wait for everybody to get on board to affect the change. What I find is you go on and you release your greatness. You, Doctor, continue to, you know, expound and enlighten and share and impart the way you do. And we are not responsible for, once it's released, what people do with it. We are just called to release it. And I think that that is the point, that we've got to move from this incessant preoccupation with, did everybody do what I said to do? Because that's me, you know, me being an empower, I want everybody to come out of there and implement and enact and make that change. But people get it at different times. Some people are early adopters. Some people are late bloomers. And I think the biggest point is, if the person who is scheduled and has that first vision, people are visionaries, and then other people are called and destined to support the vision. So everybody's not going to, it can't be all Indians or all chiefs and no Indians. There are some thought leaders that are going to first bring it to pass, and then everybody else is going to come on board. Who thought technology in its form would take over as it has? I still don't like all the technology, believe it or not, and I'm pretty young. I don't like the invasion of privacy, the fact that as I log on my computer, that it's it's noted in history forever on my computer, that if I go to a website I've never been to, next thing you know, they pop up with my Facebook emblem saying, do you want to save this? And I'm thinking, well, how did they even know who I was in 20 seconds of visiting a site? I mean, we live in a culture now where anonymity is obsolete. Okay, so for those persons who like a little quiet behind the lights, after we come off the stage, you want a little quiet, there's often not much available, so you have to create your sacred space. But in terms of the fact that each of us have been given a mission in this world, I don't care what size it is, and you cannot let your joy be stolen by futile comparison, because this person is called to have a trillion or a billion versus a million versus 100,000. Are you eating today? Are you clothed? Are you fed? Are you sheltered? Are you able to do what you need to do? And I think that's the biggest point we have to come to in this world and in this country, a spirit of gratitude. And that is where I live, in a spirit of gratitude. Mother Teresa is one of my heroes. She always knew how to be grateful for what was there. And she gave her life for the poor, and she sat amongst them and fed them. She didn't tell them, go get food. She came and fed them. She came and clothed them. She came and spent time with them. And so that kind of mantra, that kind of mission is the one I walk with. Am I doing what I'm scheduled to do at this moment? You might not have all the information at this time. That's why you keep on living to get wiser. But it's a process, and we're all called to complete this mission of life. And time is short. And we don't know when the next moment is for us. So
I agree with everything everybody was saying. The problem that I have is the 99% of the people fool themselves. We have this internet because people are lazy. They didn't want to go shopping at Macy's. They want to look online and see what Macy's has. They don't wanna go to Food Lion. They wanna get the coupons in their house so then they can go there and just get the discounted stuff. People are lazy, and that's why
we have
today, because people are lazy.
That's exactly why people don't work in this country.
That's
not
right.
Just lazy.
No.
They're poor.
And lazy and poor. The problem is, though, we had a $600 billion surplus. $600 trillion surplus when Mr. Clinton left his office. And in 8 years, it went down to, what was it?
$6 trillion
deficit. That's a $12 trillion swing. But did they
blame
him?
And there's a bigger crime. There's a bigger crime than the money is the No Child Left Behind debacle. Okay?
Oh, my God.
That's the bigger crime. Because what we did there, and the purpose of all of that No Child Left Behind was to it was an enslavement project. Initially, it started good. It started with a great plan. But the way it was conceived was good. The way it was implemented really ensured that for a generation of cannon fodder, because it ensured that we would not have any jobs available except the military, and these poor kids would end up being cannon fodder.
And then, before that was over with, Rumsfeld came in with the plan for Starship Troopers, where we were going to get rid of the entire military and make it a private industry.
That's
also known as a mercenary force. So then when we get this black man in office named Barack Obama, and he stops the bleeding from 800,000 jobs a month, 850,000 jobs a month, stops the bleeding, stops Iraq, stops we're going to pull out of Afghanistan, he has the market go from 6,000 up to 16,000, and we're not satisfied.
He's a terrible socialist.
This country here. These people are wild.
Yeah.
And you can't tell me it's just 1% anymore. It's not the 1%. It's that people are lazy and they don't do. This is a democracy. This is not a democracy. This is a representative republic. Our job is to put people in place to represent us. And if we don't like them, what they're doing, they're morons every single 2 years in office, and they say, gee, things ain't changing. And you know what? Those minorities, they're the ones that's killing us. Those people coming across the border, those black people that are on welfare, never mind that there are more white people on welfare. Never mind that. Never mind the going GIs that are coming back with no arms and no legs and we're on food stamps. Never mind that their families got dispossessed at their houses when their husband was overseas on his fifth tour. What, are you kidding me?
See, that's the difference. We voted for, you know, we were all hopeful. We said change. You know, here comes change. Their version of change is that Strom's leg fell off.
Right.
You know, but that's different.
Right.
But look, what you're talking about, ignorance and ignoring facts, we've been talking about this all day, but to mention one thing we were going to get to today and never did, but, you know, Paul Ryan's got another budget and a work program.
Yes,
well,
I remember him.
Going back to this old classroom parenting, what you said, they said that the reason Americans aren't working is that they're poor and lazy. They're stupid. They don't want to work.
Absolutely.
And that all we need to do is to cut off all the programs that are supporting them so that they'll be forced to work. And one of the facts that I like in this article that was so fantastic is that the Bureau of Labor Statistics, so there are 10 million, this is just for April alone, 10 million Americans out of work and 7 million more on just temporary jobs.
Yes.
Part-time.
All in Texas.
So that's 17 million right there in April alone. I mean, right? Well, the postings for new jobs in America, the entire country, was 4 million. Okay. So just using those
Thomas, actual, those are only the numbers that are reported.
Yes,
but that's 17 million people needing full-time work.
Right.
4 million job workers. So in that statistic alone, when they asked Ryan's co-partner here on this, Woodson, you know, what do you say about that? You can't even on your own facts, nothing to do with laziness or anything else. If every single person there could get a job, they have 4 million jobs.
Right.
So then the facts don't bear out. Nobody, that's still leaving another 13 million without jobs.
Right.
He said literally to the reporter, it's bullshit. That's all just bullshit.
Right.
That's their answer. Hey, facts, bullshit.
That's right. Let's don't get the daggone facts get in the way of the fiction.
Yeah.
We have a major problem here, and it's because people are lazy, will not. You know, the thing is, I stood up at church, I think for the last three weeks before the election, before the primary election here, and I said at the end of Mass, Father said, any news? I said, yes, there's news. I'm the communication chair for my parish council of my church, Our Lady Constellation. And I said, we're getting close to the primary election. If you do not vote now, don't have me here, you complaining. Because the primary is more important than the general. Because that's where you put the person in that you want. Not the person in that the Harvard Law School wants. Or Joe's Bar wants.
Well, that's the only time you actually have choice.
That's right.
At the end, you've got the one. You get to vote for or not.
Now, quite sure that the choice you have then is bad, too, because, hey, what moron wants to run for office? Especially we're talking about, U.S. congressional or Senate office, where they make a good living. But in most of these states that are part-time, you don't make enough money to freaking put gas in your car. Isn't that right, Grace?
Yeah.
Well, again, that's all for not having a functional government, because it might make rules and regulations that get in the way of corporations' money.
Absolutely. I mean, so, you know, well, the problem here is, you know, what did they, I just saw today, estimated 500 million people just voted in the Indian election yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
5 million! What are we going to talk about here? People in Iraq, bombs dropping in their pocketbooks, and they got purple fingers. What do we have here? Oh, I didn't know there was an election. What do you mean there's an election? It's one every 2 years.
Yeah, you know, they got, we closed a few polling stations around here.
Right. Well, yeah.
Afghanistan, they're voting up and down the sides of the Hindu Kush.
Right.
Without roads.
Without roads. Right. And here, and they, that's what these people, these regressive party people are doing. They're trying to make it so difficult that nobody votes. And, you know, And that's the problem. They make it so difficult where nobody will vote. And that is the whole thing in a nutshell. Because they do not want everyone to vote. And the thing is, just listen to this. Just listen to this.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So?
That is it, in a nutshell.
Well, what can you say about that? Dr. Grace, what can you say?
There it is. That's the reason we have voter suppression. There it is, in a nutshell.
Okay, that's it in a nutshell. Abigail, what do you say to that? Abigail?
She may not be with us anymore.
Oh, no, she's with us. No? Yeah. Abigail?
Hi, I'm sorry. Was muted out.
Okay.
Well,
what do you think about what was just played? I don't
about
want
him
to
stating
vote.
He never want everyone to vote. He believes that the numbers go down, their options go down. You know, I think it supports the initial discussion. Really, you only need a few people to get what you need done. You just need 51%. You don't need 90% in a voting arena to get that vote. You know, accomplish, and that win accomplish. I still believe that people with the vision, and I realize Michael and David and your other beautiful guest, I look at things probably at a bigger, broader level than like the intricacies. I know that you get to the minutiae because we're going to count that each vote, you know, at the polling booth. We need that one more vote, that one more vote, that one more vote. But what I believe is that when you have, you know, people with the majorities of agendas, that's why they were so upset. They're trying to redistrict all of the South because the fact that Obama was able to win in places that, you know, normally wouldn't have gone, you know, Democratic. You have populaces changing. So where you thought it was all red and all blue, there is so much mixture and migration and gentrification that has changed our electing populace. So everybody's kind of confused. So they're saying, well, let's make sure everybody has a picture ID. That'll do it. So it's always an attempt to throw off
the agenda of the people they consider non-1%. And I know that sounds weird because I don't think 99% of people are inferior. I think I'm just using the popular dialogue for the sake of understanding in this regard. It's just to say that people that have always been in charge are no longer all in charge. And that speaks to the fact that change, that tree is getting some noise. There is an undercurrent. There is a groundswell that is happening. And it's brown. It's turning brown all over the country. And I love every culture. I love every hue. I have friends of all backgrounds, et cetera. So when I make this statement, I'm not making it to sound like, you know, there'll be no liar persuasion present. I'm not trying to create fear. I'm saying to recognize that the places that they thought were not empowered have now become empowered. China is now a world power. They're brown people. Do you understand what I'm saying? India has become an economic force because all of our jobs are shipped there. All of their people and their citizens are being trained with technology that our country is too lazy to fully understand. We'd rather buy an Apple iPad, iPhone, and every other gadget but never know how it works. And so we just got the just this week on I don't want to mention the other station, but for the sake of this discussion, they just had the newest findings come out for America. For America 2 days ago that showed that the high school population of American students, via, no matter if it was preparatory, parochial, or public, that the reading ability of the entire high school population has gone down and diminished, and that the math scores in the African American community remain inferior to the mainstream. But overall, Caucasians, you know, private school, parochial, all of the reading ability of America is down. And so I always have been of this mindset that we're in a dumbed down America. People don't want to think anymore. They don't want to write in a complete sentence. We are in a changing landscape. And Europe, and all the other cultures that are happening to be brown are ready to take over for the laziness that you said, Michael. People don't want to go to Macy's. They don't want to go to Food Lion. They want to look and click and see. That kind of laziness, that kind of dumbing down, is having amazing repercussions and impact on our culture overall. And it translates and it triggers into our voting populaces. And it's all shifting, and they don't know what to do.
David, what do you think about that?
Hey, who? By the way, Michael, who was that that made that statement that you
that
played?
That was Paul Reinwick, who's the father of the conservative movement department.
Wow. Wow. Well, you know, I think we've talked about this off air before about, you know, the voting and how all that works. And I honestly believe that there's always been a movement by those in power to, you know, disrupt the populace. Okay. I've always believed that. And just like what's going on with the Republicans have done down in your region, you know, with all these new laws that the governor's enacted with the voting cards and all that, that's all designed to, you know, like the young lady was just saying, to dissuade that percentage of the populace that are deemed upon as looked upon as being insignificant. Okay.
Right.
So I firmly believe that that's always been. It was a true statement with the guy. I didn't like hearing what the guy said, but it's a true statement because the voting power has always done something.
Absolutely. Moving on here, I want to have everybody chime in on this. There was just recently, if I could pull it up here, if I remember where the heck it's at, there was an incident in Wolfsboro, New Hampshire, and it was the town's white police commissioner that called Obama the N-word. Nearsighted. He called him nearsighted, right. And he said, A police commissioner in a predominantly white New Hampshire town says he won't apologize for calling President Obama the N-word as he sat down with his arms crossed and angrily stared at residents indignant and would not offer his resignation. Woodsboro Police Commissioner Robert Woodsboro's police commissioner, one of the commissioners, Robert Copeland, who's 82 and white, has acknowledged in an email to fellow police commissioners he used a racial slur in describing Obama. Town resident Jane O'Toole, who moved to Woodsboro 4 months ago, says she overheard Copeland say the slur at a restaurant in March and wrote to the town manager about it. Copeland, in an email to her, acknowledged that he used a racial slur and said he would not apologize. I believe I did use the N-word in reference to the current occupant of the White House.
He won't even say president.
He won't even say president. He's an occupant, like trespasser. Copeland said in an email to his fellow police commissioners, part of which he forwarded to O'Toole, "For this, I do not apologize." He meets and exceeds my criteria for such. Copeland has declined to be interviewed, okay, and he says he will not be disciplined. And he said that he is renting 3-year term on his office. About 20 black people live in Woodsboro, a town of 6,300 residents in the scenic lake region in the Central Park of New Hampshire. The state that's 94% white and 1% black, none of the town police department's 12 full-time officers is black or a member of any minority. Okay? Now.
But they all have clean sheets.
But they all have clean sheets, yes. Okay. David, what do you have to say about that?
Hey, you know, when you said his age, that kind of like gave me some kind of, you know, comfort.
Yeah,
because he appears to come out of the old boy network from down south. But I'm not surprised, and I'm not overly surprised by that, Michael. As you very well know, I live in New England, okay, and I know that New Hampshire as well as Vermont, they have a minority population of less than 1%. Okay, in many instances. Okay, but for a town official, someone with that high ranking, you know, of status, to make that kind of statement, it's just unconscionable in 2014. Unbelievable. You know, I mean, the city council needs to make some kind of movement to unseat that guy.
It said nearly 24 speakers at Thursday's meeting called for Copeland to quit, and 2 spoke for his defense. Resident Frank Bader mocked those who took offense at Copeland's comments in a state that prizes freedom. All this man did was express his displeasure with a man who's in office.
Again,
how about that?
Again, without a title.
Abigail, what do you think of that? Abigail
takes breaks.
Abigail.
Yeah, I did. You know, I'm just...
What do you think of that?
Wow. Oh, God. You know, that point, the N-word, you know, Michael, it's so loaded. It's so loaded. I got to be honest. I'm having a problem with the way we do have a double standard with this N-word. And I think that, you know, we don't like it when the Caucasians use it and all of those things, but do we have a responsibility? This is my question. This is my question back to you all, to the panel, is, you know, should we be held, those that are African-American, should we be held to the same standards of refusing to use the N-word like we demand that all of these other persons that have assaulted us in the media, verbally assaulted the president, should we be held to the same standards? Because I'm wrestling with that myself. I'm upset about it, but I hear Caucasian persons, teens, et cetera, quoting rap lyrics just walking down the road, and they're quoting what was in the rap song. And so, you know, I just don't know if we have got to come to a place of our own accountability where we must stop
That's one of the first things I disagree with her on, Michael.
I'm asking the question.
Hey, the thing is that he wasn't repeating a rap song.
I was just going to say, there's intent behind things.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Kids, you know, often say things to themselves
that
might sound derogatory, like call each other fools or bitches or whatever to their friends.
Right.
And mean one thing by it.
Right.
Whereas this guy calling the occupant of the one, you know, the...
Hey, listen.
He didn't mistake anything.
I'm more upset about him saying the occupant of the White House than saying the kid.
Again, it's a lack of respect all the way around.
That's right.
I think it was nothing but disrespectful. It was just pure disrespect. And, no, you can wax philosophic about it, but there you go. It was disrespectful. These people need to be, suffer some consequences. Absolutely.
Yeah, well,
the other side to this, as a public law official, he needs to be held accountable to the highest possible standards, and he needs to be removed immediately. Because you can't have a double standard. If he was a citizen and said something bad, maybe he'll be shunned. Maybe some people wouldn't serve him coffee in the diner or something. But as a law enforcement officer, you got to be kidding me. There's no way.
Well, I want to
answer Abigail's question.
Go ahead, Dave.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, she posed a question to the panel. Should African Americans and minorities be held accountable or held at the same standard when we use the term? Okay.
Yes.
But I disagree with her because I believe that it's the context in which the term is used. When you look at the subcultural origins of the word, okay, in the white community, it comes up out of racial hatred. The origins of that term comes out of racial hatred. When you look at the minorities in the black community, that word comes up out of a subcultural context of a term of endearment. So it's not the same thing. It sounds the same.
Minute.
It's not even spelled the
is
same
this
way.
David? Is this David again speaking?
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Oh, I love it. We definitely have energies that are synergistic and may slightly have a little bit of a differentiation. In that regard,
she don't agree with you, David.
Michael, no, he caught that. He caught that so wisely. I've heard that stated.
What the hell are you talking about? That's what you wanted to say.
No, you know, it's funny because I must be honest, in front of God and everybody in the public, I've used the N-word myself. Ooh, I can't believe, right? I admitted it. I'm doing my own therapy. I've utilized that N-word, but I must be honest with you, David, and others of you on the panel. No, the white cop was absolutely ignorant, okay? Understand that I detest it with everything in me. But furthermore, I can recall the times that I've used that N-word, I was definitely saying, you know what, those are some ignorant N-words. Or that person, you know, you understand, there was no love, there was no camaraderie, there was no fellowship. I don't usually walk around calling everybody my N-word. And I know that there's a great rap song now that makes you want to say it. My hitter. That's how they diffuse it on the major radio stations. And it has rhythm, and it has, you know, that great staccato and that beat and that hump and that bump. But by and large, I love what Dr. Maya Angelou states, and she's one of my great heroes. She says, it matters not what others call me. It matters most what I call myself. And for us to be in 2014 trying to define ourselves by the very people that oppressed us, trying to use their words to say we're redefining it, I think that there's an expansive enough vocabulary in our American dialect and dialogue that we can use other words of endearment, like my brother. I love you, my sister. You're beautiful. Oh, I love your skin. Oh, I love your brilliance. I love your intellect. And I know that every N-word is not going to be erased from our family reunions, our fraternities. But by and large, I'm believing we should get to a point.
My dear Abigail, you are so sweet and so not
eat that. I don't know what.
My dear ignorant beloved sister.
Right.
You can't roll off the
system. You see what I'm saying? You see how empowering that sounded? That was beautiful.
Right.
Sometimes, because of their use,
yes,
may have nothing to do with the word or the symbol.
That's right.
Just like the Nazis using the swastika.
You're right.
Ruined forever one of the earliest Christian symbols, because it was an early cross they were using, and they have destroyed that emblem. Now, you can't use that symbol without it, the connotation being negative. Sometimes words or deeds or symbols become so heinous that you cannot then use them anymore. And this is one of those words. Kind of, it's just, at least that I can see, there's no good use for it. There is no way.
And more than that, yes, sir, to your point, African Americans are the only group that is known in America to call themselves by the most hated and oppressed name that they were given during the most horrific time in the history of our culture. You don't hear Jews readily calling themselves spics and all of the other negative connotations that they've been given. Only African Americans do that, and that is a further sign of the success of the oppression. And in 2014, we have to think higher, that we don't have to let that be the thing that they get to even slip and say, because it's still so widely celebrated amongst the people that were oppressed. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's an energy. Yep. It's a spirit of the word, and we can make justification all we want. But guess what? Every time it comes out of a lighter persuasion person's mouth, we're ready to shoot everybody up and run, parade down major streets. But we can't see the pain that still is there, even though it's coming out of a brown mouth. That, to me, is insanity. And that's all I'm saying.
Well,
it's insanity.
To her point, is it a term that some may find offensive? Of course. And even she said that she admitted herself as using the N-word, and it wasn't a term of endearment. You know, it actually described, a negative aspect of a person's character traits. You know, however, my argument still is the same. It's not the same context, okay? And, despite the fact that it is a term that derives out of the bondage of black people in this country, the youth have reinvented the word and kind of used it, turned a negative into a positive. Okay, are there older people, or there are people who are still offended by the way we were treated during the earlier stages of this country?
Yeah,
true. There are. They exist. However, you cannot, ignore the fact that it is a term that came up out of a subcultural environment within the African-American community, okay, and it was given in a different context. It is not the same context, and I'll debate that all day long. You know, and I know people don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear young black people who really don't know their history using that term, but it's not the same context, and I just have to argue that point.
Well, I think it's David because you still want to use it, but that's just my opinion.
No. I rarely use that word. I rarely use that term.
Okay.
A lot of times, and I've never used it in the context of that ignorant such and such. I've never used it in that context. You know.
Okay.
But the thing is, I just believe that I think that we are given. We're criticized a little bit too harshly about that, because there are other words that we've used that are derogatory, that were meant to be derogatory towards us and other ethnicities, okay, but that we've turned around into a positive. That's just uniqueness of the African-American, ingenuity, our creative spirit. You know, a lot of things that were done, to us that we were labeled, we turned it around to a positive thing, and we're utilizing it in a subcultural setting. Okay, that does not, refer to race, does not refer to oppression or anything like that. And I just don't like to hear people say, well, young people need to stop saying that word. You need to understand the origins of the term, okay?
Yep.
And perhaps if we teach our young people the origins of that word, then perhaps they may stop using it. But I just I'll argue all day long that it's just the context that the term is used in.
I thank you. David, tell us, how can we get a hold of you on the Internet.
Okay. As you very well know, Michael, I'm the at thepeopleschampion.me. That's thepeopleschampion.me.
And Miss Abigail, how can we get a hold of you?
You can simply go to my namesake. It's simply abigailmotes.com, and the correct spelling for that is A-B-I-G-A-I-L, capital M-O-A, T like Tom, S like Sam, motes.com. And I'm a total empowerer. I speak to organizations, churches, women's groups, and I'm also a financial services professional, and so I can work with you on retirement planning, savings, legacy building, all of the above. I love you all. Each of you today has given me food for thought, given me further inspiration, and I want to thank you, Michael, for this awesome invitation and this opportunity. I love it. I love thinking people, and AbigailMotes.com is how you can reach out to me, and I'd be so grateful to talk with any of you.
And I want to tell you, you know, see, you got to be very smart because you took that that test to become a registered rep in New York, which I was a registered rep for IDS long time ago. It's a hard test.
Yes, I'm with New York Life, right, with New York Life, and they're number one. So I'm a financial services. I can do all of it. I can do investments. I can do insurance and all of the above. So I look to work with many of your listeners and to be a part of something going forward. You know, I'm new to Charlotte. I've been here 5 weeks. And I want to thank you for the love, the Charlentean welcome, having a good time, and excited about connecting with each of you in the space that I can. Thank you so much.
I hope to see you on Tuesday. And
my sister and I will be there.
That is about it. We're wrapping up for this. We will not be here next Friday because I'm taking a vacation.
You deserve
it. We don't need any stinking vacation.
This is America.
This
work.
Is America. Work.
Get
right.
Back to work.
And Memorial Day? Something coming up?
Memorial Day. Mm-hmm.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. And we are going to go out with one of my all-time songs. And I just want to thank again.
Thanks, David.
David.
Thanks, Abigail.
Adam.
Thank you, sweetheart. Thank you, David. Thank you. The doctor lady. Love her, too.
I'll see you tomorrow. No, I won't see you tomorrow because we're going to be at two different events. Okay, guys. Have a happy and have a good holiday weekend next Monday. Jesus.